Okay, Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and good morning all, and welcome to the first meeting of 2021 of the State Historical Resources Commission. My name is Lee Adams, and I'm the 2021 chair, and I'm going to convene this meeting of the commission. Today's meeting of the State Historical Resources Commission has been duly noticed. Any and all of the agenda items are subject to action by the commission. And sadly, at this time, I would like to ask for a moment of silence for Commissioner Marshall McKay, who passed on December 29th. Thank you all. With that, we will go to the Pledge of Allegiance, and I would ask all to stand as they are able and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge
Pledge
allegiance
allegiance
to
to
the
the
flag
flag
of
of
the
the
United
United
States
States
of
of America.
America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Again, good morning. My name is Lee Adams. I represent the public, and I am from Downeyville in Sierra County with 10 inches of snow this morning. And I would hope that all of my colleagues will introduce themselves, and we will do this by first name, because I was reminded at our last meeting we have three commissioners whose last name starts with an H, so it becomes a food fight. So we will start with first name, and we will start with our vice chair, Adam.
Everybody, my name is Adam Sriro. I am from Culver City, California, and I am the archaeology manager for Southern California Edison, and I represent archaeology on the commission.
Alan, you're up.
I'm up. Okay. I'm Alan Hess. I represent architecture on the commission. And I am speaking to you from Irvine, California.
B is for Brian.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Brian Brandis. I represent the public, and I am now living in Oakland, California.
You're on, Janet.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Janet Hansen, and I am from Palm Springs, and I represent history on the commission.
And it looks like I'm next, because I start with R, and my name is Renee Volanowith. I'm a professor of archaeology at California State University, Los Angeles. I represent a Native American archaeology on the commission, and I welcome everybody.
Thanks, Renee, and sorry, whether we go by first or last name, you're going to be last, it appears. I guess we could do it by height next time. Thank you all, and now we will, I get to introduce proudly our State Historic Preservation Officer, Julianne Polanco, and I will have her introduce herself and members of her staff.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and congratulations on your first meeting. Nice to have you aboard in this capacity. With us today, we have Tara Lynch, our chief counsel, Janon Saunders, our deputy SHPO and tribal liaison, Jay Correa, the head of our registration unit, Mike McGirt, our archaeology supervisor, Amy Crane and William Berg of our registration unit, and Jesse Ochoa Diaz, who is our program assistant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julie. And again, welcome to all. I would like to mention that this is our fourth virtual meeting. Please be patient while we work through the agenda. And even worse for this poor commission, this is my first meeting as chair. So really bear with us. We're going to move on to item five, and that is resolutions. And it is my great honor and pleasure as chair to present a resolution to the County of Los Angeles. And I'm wondering if we have anybody with us today representing Los Angeles County.
I'm looking at the attendees list. If anyone on the attendees list is the representative from Los Angeles County, could you raise your hand? I fear we possibly do not have anyone. Hold on, we'll just give it a second. I don't think we have anyone who's on the phone. There's a different way to raise your hand if you're on the phone. All right. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like we have anyone from Los Angeles County at the meeting.
At least anybody who is not shy. So I am going to recognize Los Angeles County, Janan. This is a pretty rare honor. This is only the 69th local government so recognized in California and just the 7th county so recognized. And this is our resolution number 2021-01, and it's a resolution of recognition for the County of Los Angeles. And it does read, whereas Congress declared in the National Historic Preservation Act that it shall be the policy of the federal government in partnership with state and local governments to foster conditions under which our modern society and our prehistoric and historic resources can exist in productive harmony. And whereas the National Park Service in the state of California through the Office of Historic Preservation, California State Parks, has established the Certified Local Government Program to carry out this policy. And whereas the program recognizes local governments which have legislated a preservation program, including a qualified cultural resources commission, which identifies and designates significant cultural resources to be protected for future generations, and which advises the local government on actions which affect these resources. And whereas on January 13th, 2020, the County of Los Angeles was, with the recommendation of the State Historic Preservation Officer, approved by the United States Department of Interior to be a certified local government. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the State Historical Resources Commission and the State Historic Preservation Officer recognize that the Department of the Interior has invested with the County of Los Angeles all the responsibilities and benefits of certification. And be it further resolved that this resolution be recorded in the minutes of the State Historical Resources Commission and a suitable copy presented to the County of Los Angeles. And this is dated today and signed by Shippo Polanco and the commission chair. And again, just a hearty congratulations to Los Angeles County. And again, I will assume we have nobody online wishing to necessarily comment.
Mr. Chair, we'll be sure to get that to Los Angeles with all the congratulations that you all bestowed on them. And you are right. It's a great thing to have our local governments become certified local governments. They can take advantage of grants and technical assistance and really help their communities to retain and preserve and celebrate their history.
Thanks, Julie. We will move on to item six, and this is approval of the two summary of meetings, and one is November 6, 2020, and then our meeting workshop on December 10th, 2020. All commissioners received a copy of the draft of the summaries of minutes from the last two meetings. Please note that this is a summary and official minutes are the recording of the meetings, which are available through the OHP website. Are there any comments from commissioners on the summary, including any proposed additions, deletions, or other revisions? I don't see anybody waving hands. Is there a motion to approve the summaries?
Yep, I'll make a motion to approve the summaries.
Thank you. We have a motion by Commissioner Brandis.
I second the motion.
Thank you. Commissioner Hansen seconds, and the motion is to approve both the summary of minutes. And I will ask Tara to please do a roll call vote.
Thank you. Brandis.
Aye.
Hansen.
Yes.
Hess.
Aye.
Hoyos is absent. Shrero.
Aye.
Ulanowicz.
Aye.
Adams.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 600.
Thank you, Tara. So we will move on to item 7, commission and staff reports. And as far as a chairperson's report, just a little bit of housekeeping information for everybody on the Zoom call today. If you wish to make a verbal comment on one of the agenda items, or if you wish to make a comment during the open comment period, you must be using Zoom or calling in by phone. If you're currently watching the webcast on calspan.org, but you want to comment, you must register using the link at www.ohp.parks.ca.gov/SHRC notices. The link is at the end of the first bold paragraph on that page. You will receive an email with a link and phone number for this meeting. We will be calling on speakers in the order identified in the meeting notice and within each category of speaker in order in which you registered for the meeting. After we go through those attendees who registered for specific agenda items, we will ask for anyone else who wants to speak on the agenda item to raise your hand. If you are calling in on telephone, dial *9 to raise your hand. We will call each commenter by name and allow that person to speak, and the commenters will then need to unmute themselves. If you are calling in on phone, you did this by pressing *6. Please note you will not appear by video during your testimony. I would also like to remind everyone, commenters, board members, and staff to please state your name for the record before you speak. And if you're speaking on behalf of an organization, state the organization's name. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen. For those only calling in by phone, we will remind you when you have 1 minute remaining. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text to area code 805-801-3576 or email agp, that's Adam George Paul, video.com, and an IT person will assist you. And just a note for the commissioners, anybody who needs a break or needs to step away, please state that you are leaving temporarily so that we can keep our quorum, especially important today. And again, if anybody needs a break, text me or text Julie, and we will break as is appropriate. And I think that's it for my comments. And I will now ask our executive secretary if she has a report today.
I do. Thank you, Chairman Adams. I appreciate the moment of silence for our former commissioner, Marshall McKay. We all will miss him and his contributions, and particularly the things that he brought to the table in teaching us to be better at what we do. I also wanted to let everybody know that we have additionally information about the loss of a former OHP staff, Sandy Elder, and the first, and I think perhaps the fifth, State Historic Preservation Officer, Dr. Knox Mellon, both of whom were in the office in the early days. And as you know, Dr. Mellon has been so instrumental, not only in the preservation movement in California and in our office, but mentoring many of our colleagues and friends over the years. I had a great honor of visiting he and his wife, Carlotta, in their home in Carmel last year when I was in the area for a meeting, and we sat at a table over cookies and milk and shared stories about the office and the early days. And I was able to let him know about the work we're doing today and the legacy that he provided in the foundation for us to be able to do that. So I just wanted to recognize those two very important people in our in the history of the Office of Historic Preservation and Preservation in California. I also just wanted to acknowledge that with the many numbers of people in this time of COVID, many of our family members and friends as well have passed, and we give our condolences to our colleagues on the passing of their loved ones as well. One item of note for housekeeping, Pomeroy Green is gonna be pulled off of the consent agenda, and we'll hear it on discussion and action after the stuffed shirt. That was in relation to the certified local government Code 54, Section 302.504. Amy Crane will give more information in her report on that, but it's being pulled out of an abundance of caution in light of the certified local government letter that we received. General updates, our consultations continue to be overflowing and very interesting. We have lots of requests for programmatic agreements, both large process programmatic agreements for agencies as well as project specifics. I think that we have been seeing an increase in consultation with tribes and the public, and we look forward to that continuing with our federal partners. We are working with the state of California, the state parks, our parent agency, on the project that we have for climate vulnerability assessments. We've partnered with Scripps Institute to look at the way in which climate vulnerability assessments for sites are conducted. This is where people identify the important attributes and then the climate threats, model them to future climate predictions, and use this as a tool for stewardship of the site. Typically, they have not included cultural resources, and so we're using a format and testing this at a site in California State Parks in China Camp in Marin County. And then we're looking at two potential sites in Southern California, one on Catalina Island and one in the San Diego County area, to understand how to derive the value portion of a climate vulnerability assessment to include adjacent communities and our tribal partners. We're very excited about that effort, and we are getting underway next week on that with our first meeting. Additionally, you've been hearing for the last 2 years now about our California missions from the stories of the Native Americans, our partners on that context statement. I'm happy to announce that we have our first advisory committee meeting on February 5th. That meeting will really just be going over what the format is, engaging with the the advisory committee, and beginning to start to identify our process, the themes. We will absolutely be addressing issues of confidentiality and then get going. And that will be a most amazing effort. I will ask that Marshall McKay was the commission representative on that advisory committee, Mr. Chair. And so if you want to think about if there's another commissioner that would like to join us, we'd be more than happy to have them on board. Additionally, very excitingly, we will be next week releasing the RFP, the request for proposals for the second phase of our Asian Pacific Islanders in the 20th Century Historic Context Statement. You might remember that we received money from the National Park Service combined with some of our office money to do a first pass. And we identified all the themes, but the funding only allowed us to complete a portion of it with the promise of money to come. And I'm very happy to report that we will be funding the completion of that study with the RFP going out next week. Additionally, we received as a mitigation for the Brace and Bolt program throughout the state, funds from FEMA to conduct workshops on historic homes with the intention of aiding the homeowner on how to understand historic properties, what's character defining about their particular home that may be subject to these kinds of interventions, and then how to work with contractors. So there will be several modules. The first two will be strictly about identifying the character defining features and understanding that. And then the next two will be specifically about the Brace and Bolt program. But in the context of this framework for the workshops, we separated them out so those first two modules will be able to be used for CAL FIRE when they work on their regulations and their rules for fire hardening of buildings. They'll be able to be used for any seismic upgrade projects that people work on, as well as any potential sea level rise or climate change adaptations that might be forthcoming. So staff did a really amazing job of putting that RFP out, and we're about to get going on submitting and sending the RFP out for people to bid on, but to get more mileage out of those workshops and to make them understandable from the homeowner perspective. It'll also include a summary of the existing information that we and our partners have put together. So there'll be a compendium of resources included. And then finally, we are about to embark on our historic tax credit regulations process. That historic tax credit bill was not funded in the last budget. We don't have information about whether it'll be funded in this budget, but we do need to put the regulations together so that we're ready when money is available to implement the program. So stay tuned. We'll be following up on that. And then the CRIS report, I think, will hold for the discussion so that we don't take up time twice for the same conversation. And we also don't sort of separate it in a way that makes it hard for you and the public to follow. And then finally, I was remiss in not recognizing Twyla Willis-Hunter, our executive assistant and assistant to the commission, who is also with us today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I finish my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Do any commissioners have any questions or comments for anything Julie spoke on? Okay, seeing none, we will move on to our consent calendar. And as Julie mentioned, there will be some changes to it that we will do in a second. But for now, just a opening statement for those on the Zoom call and on phone. The commission will now hear nominations and any comments concerning the eligibility of the nominated properties for the National Register of Historic Places based on the evidence presented, including the nomination and any comments received regarding the nomination and the nominated properties, including testimony presented at this meeting. The commission will determine whether the property or properties meet the criteria of the applicable register program. For nominations to the National Register of Historic Places, the commission will then make a recommendation to the State Historic Preservation Officer regarding forwarding the nomination to the keeper of the National Register of Historic Places for action by the keeper. The commission only considers evidence relating specifically to the applicable register criteria and not any social or economic matters related to a nomination or a nominated property. All properties that are listed or determined eligible for listing in the National Register are automatically listed in the California Register of Historical Resources. Furthermore, all properties listed in the California Register of Historic Landmark Program, including and following landmark number 770, are automatically listed in the California Register. The commission will hear those nominations that are on consent calendar one of the agenda. Such nominations are on the consent calendar because OHP is not aware of any opposition to the nominations. Information concerning the nominations on the consent calendar has been forwarded to each commissioner prior to this meeting and is on file at OHP. Unless a member of the audience or a commissioner requests that a nomination on the consent calendar be withdrawn from the consent calendar, the commission will not hear testimony on the nominations and will vote on the consent calendar nominations in a single motion. If a nomination is withdrawn from the consent calendar, the commission will hear testimony and consider such nominations later in the meeting. And before I ask for any nominations to be withdrawn, as Shippo Polanco has mentioned, Pomeroy Green is being pulled and it will be heard separately after our other item this afternoon. And with that, is there any member of the audience that requests a nomination be withdrawn from the consent calendar?
I'm looking for raised hands. I see none.
Okay, thanks, Janon. And at this time, I would ask, is there any commissioner that requests a nomination be withdrawn from the consent calendar? Okay, I would also ask, is there any commissioner that wishes to recuse him or herself from hearing the consent calendar? And finally, is there any commissioner that wishes to disclose discussions with any parties on matters listed on the consent calendar? Okay, seeing none, the commission welcomes comments on the consent calendar items following approval. Any person wishing to address the commission on a consent calendar item but not wishing to remove it should have submitted a speaking request to OHP via the OHP website prior to this meeting. We have a list of those who have requested to speak regarding properties on the consent calendar. When we identify it as time for those members of the public to address the commission following action on the consent calendar, I would like to also mention, and I should have today, that I really appreciate the assistance of Janon Saunders. She is sort of our air traffic controller for Zoom, and without her and her ability, these meetings would not work. So thanks, Janon. And with that, Office of Historic Preservation staff will now present information about each of the five properties now on the consent calendar. So good morning, William, Jay, and Amy.
Good morning. The one-story, wood-framed Redwood City Women's Club was constructed in the craftsman style in 1911 in the Dingy Park neighborhood. Significant features include wooden shingles, a projecting gabled porte cochere, the gabled and pyramidal roof, exposed purlins with pointed ends, and bargeboard with carved rafter ends. The porte cochere fronts a recessed porch that serves as the main entrance. In composition, the front of the building is symmetrical, with slightly projecting wings flanking the porch and porte cochere. Next slide, please. In 1939, a shingle dining room was added to the south side, filling in an L, and two attic-level windows were filled in. In 1973, a shingled addition to the dining room was made to the rear of the building. Both the 1939 and the 1973 additions are, in their materials and details, entirely compatible with the building's craftsman style. The landscaping is not original. Despite these changes, the building retains all aspects of integrity. Next. The Redwood City Women's Club building is nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of social history, women's history, and under Criterion C in the area of architecture. The club was founded to create social, educational, and benevolent opportunities for the women of Redwood City. Next. One of several local women's organizations of the period, the Redwood City Women's Club was the only one to own its own building. Built by local contractor Charles Miller, the clubhouse embodies the distinctive characteristics of the craftsman's style and possesses high artistic values. The period of significance begins with construction in 1911, through a 1939 addition, closing in 1949, after which the membership of about 300 declined significantly. Next, please. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the owner. The Historic Resources Advisory Committee, in its role as representative of Redwood City, a certified local government, received a copy of the nomination. No letters have been received. Next, please. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Redwood City Women's Club is eligible under National Register Criteria A and C at the local level of significance with a 1911 to 1949 period of significance. Next, please. Thomas Jefferson School is located on a 1.18-acre parcel one block east of Capitol Park in Sacramento's Midtown neighborhood at the transition between large government and commercial buildings to the north and west, and single and multifamily residential to the southeast. The 1922 building is an architecturally significant example of a Tudor Revival school designed under the aegis of the Sacramento School District's Architectural and Engineering Commission, formed in 1920. Next, please. The main H-plan two-story building is brick construction with concrete framing and foundation and clay tile roof. Single-story rear additions are board form concrete. The building has 20,250 square feet of interior space. Tudor Revival architecture is expressed throughout its steeply pitched roof forms, combination of brick and stucco cladding, decorative chimneys, and a highly ornamental entry volume featuring terracotta coins and sundial. Its clay tile roof and large multiple light windows are features common to the schools produced by the Sacramento School District's 1920s construction program. The school building retains all aspects of integrity. Next, please. Jefferson School is nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture as a building that embodies the distinctive characteristics of the Tudor Revival style of architecture. Next, please. Designed by two master architects, Sacramento School District's Architectural and Engineering Commission Chairman, E.C. Hemmings, and James Dean of Dean & Dean, The building exemplifies the school district's distinctive architecture program of the 1920s. The period of significance is 1922, the year construction was completed. Next, please. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of Preservation Sacramento, a nonprofit education and advocacy organization. The Preservation Commission, in its role as representative of the City of Sacramento, a certified local government, received a copy of the nomination. The nomination was scheduled for discussion at the Preservation Commission's January 20th, 2021 meeting. When the meeting had to be canceled, the Preservation Director sent a letter of support. No other letters have been received. Next, please. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Jefferson School is eligible under National Register Criterion C at the local level of significance with a 1922 period of significance. Next, please. North Sacramento School is located in a residential Old North Sacramento neighborhood characterized by single-family residences constructed between 1910 and 1960. Del Paso Boulevard, the neighborhood's principal commercial thoroughfare, cuts through the north-south street grid diagonally, just northwest of the school building, which is sited on three adjoining parcels that total 2.53 acres. The one-story Mission Spanish Colonial Buildings Complex symmetrical plan is formed by several connecting rectangular volumes. Next, please. The main north facade is dominated by the 1.5-story central auditorium volume with clay tile gabled roof, which is flanked by projecting classroom wings. A three-sided arcade lines the front courtyard formed by the auditorium and interior wings. Ornamental features include a tower elaborated by blind arches with diminutive classical columns projecting from the southeast corner of the auditorium, as well as shaped parapets, buttressed walls, and recessed window assemblages with classical columns on projecting interior wings. Next, please. Built in stages beginning in 1915, with additions in 1920, 1922, 1926, and 1947, the building is constructed of a combination of hollow clay tile and wood frame with stucco cladding and concrete foundation. Research through the Sacramento County Assessor and the school district did not reveal the building's square footage, nor was the specific size of the building revealed in contemporaneous newspaper reports. Although the building has not been used as a school for many decades, North Sacramento School has been altered only slightly and retains all aspects of integrity. Next, please. North Sacramento School is nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of community planning and development, for its association with the foundation, growth, and development of the community of North Sacramento and with the establishment and growth of the North Sacramento School District. The school is also nominated under Criterion C, embodying the distinctive characteristics of Mission Spanish Colonial Revival architecture and as a significant example of the work of master architects C.C. Cuff and E.C. Hemmings. Next, please. The period of significance is 1915 to 1953. The school's period of use, which mirrored the community's era as a vibrant independent city, and the school's role as an amenity utilized by boosters to promote growth. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of Preservation Sacramento, a nonprofit education and advocacy organization. The Preservation Commission, in its role as representative of the City of Sacramento, a certified local government, received a copy of the nomination. Next, please. The nomination was scheduled for discussion at the Preservation Commission's January 20th, 2021 meeting. When the meeting had to be canceled, the Preservation Director sent a letter of support. No other letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine North Sacramento School is eligible under National Register Criteria A and C at the local level of significance with a 1915 to 1953 period of significance. Consent calendar staff reports will continue with the Edward and America Griffith Residence National Register nomination presented by William Burke.
The Edward and America Griffith Residence is a large cliffside property in the Three Arch Bay community in the South Laguna neighborhood of Laguna Beach. The residence overlooks an intimate cove framed by rocky outcroppings along the Pacific Ocean. The residence consists of five contributing buildings: the main house, chart house, guest house, old garage, and lighthouse, and three contributing structures: the beach stairs, bridge to tidal pool, and tidal pool, and one non-contributing building, the new garage, along with associated landscape and hardscape. The buildings are principally reflective of colonial revival Cape Cod architecture known in Laguna Beach as the beach cottage style and accented with nautical references. The residence's contributing buildings were constructed between 1927 and 1932. The main house has an L-shaped floor plan on a raised foundation with a complex cross-gabled roof. The concrete shingled roof features exposed rafters in its shallow overhanging eaves. Two brick chimneys and a wood cupola disguise a vent rise above the roof line. The main house is two stories high with broad horizontal wood siding with brick accents. Windows are wood framed except for a bronze bay window on the north elevation, including double hung, casement, and fixed, with a mixture of single and multiple panes, some with strategically placed porthole windows. The chart house is a small two-story building of approximately 360 square feet. The first floor is reputed to have been a chart house salvaged from the steamship Mary Dollar. The exterior is clad in wood paneling and board and batten siding with porthole windows, multi-light windows on the second story, and skylights. The second story is accessed by a ladder on the building's west side. The guest house is a small two-story building. It has a rectangular plan and has two stories, clad in horizontal wood siding and capped with a side gabled roof with wood shingles. The west elevation facing the ocean has three multi-light windows. The building is set into the hillside, and the second story at the street level was most likely originally used as a garage. The old garage is a one-story, front gabled roof with exposed rafter tails and a vertical slat vent in the east gable end, and a gabled dormer facing south. Clad in wood siding, the garage has a capacity of two automobiles. The lighthouse is a three-story, non-functional lighthouse tower without a beacon. The first two levels are circular in plan with whitewashed brick exterior walls. Windows are recessed with segmental arch heads of soldier bricks, and the main entry door has a porthole. The top floor is hexagonal and sheathed in stucco, topped with a bell-like domed roof, clad in standing seam copper, with portholes in each direction, topped by a weather vane. The beach stairs descend the cliff face in a series of switchbacks. Supported by posts from the beach to each landing, the stairs are brick-walled, and the top third with a mixture of wood, metal, and concrete, including some in-kind replacement of wooden stairs. The stairs end in a bridge that serves as a narrow elevated walkway to the tidal pool, constructed of concrete. The concrete tidal pool is built into the rocks at the south end of the beach, L-shaped and edged by stone and concrete coping. A break in the coping allows the high tide to fill the pool. The property is nominated under Criterion B for its association with filmmaker Edward Hilaire Griffith and actress America Chedister Griffith, early inhabitants of the Three Arch Bay community who, in addition to their show business careers, were very involved in community affairs, and their home was used for business and entertaining of the emerging Hollywood elite, directly linked to their professional careers as well as their community activism. The period of significance begins with the earliest construction in 1927 through 1957, when the Griffiths had ended their show business careers and ended their last major participation in Laguna Beach civic affairs, their campaign to create a community services district to provide infrastructure and maintenance for the Three Arch Bay community. The property is nominated by Chattel Inc. on behalf of the property owner. Two letters of support, including one from the City of Laguna Beach, has been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Edward and America Griffith residence eligible for the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion B at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1927 to 1957. Hotel Mayfair, located on West 7th Street between Whitmer Street and Hartford Avenue in the Westlake neighborhood of Los Angeles, is a 13-story plus mezzanine hotel building constructed in the Renaissance Revival style, consisting of a 3-story plus mezzanine base with a square plan, supporting a 9-story tower with L-shaped plan and a flat roof. The steel frame of the building is clad with hollow clay tile infill walls and rose-colored ruffle-faced brick laid in Flemish bond with terracotta details by Gladding McBean. Fenestration consists of rectangular sliding metal sash windows with fixed spandrel lights and projecting terracotta subsills. The hotel was designed by the distinguished local architectural firm of Curlett and Bielman and completed in 1926. The property is nominated under Criterion C as the significant work of a master architect. Although there have been some alterations over time, including recladding of the first floor with cast concrete in place of marble, with alterations to ground floor facade and removal of rooftop neon sign, terracotta finials, and fire escapes, the building retains overall a high degree of historic integrity. The property's period of significance is 1926, the year the building was completed. The property is nominated on behalf of the property owner as part of a historic rehabilitation tax credit project completed in 2019. No letters of support or objection have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Hotel Mayfair eligible for the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion C at the local level of significance with a period of significance of 1926. This concludes the consent calendar description PowerPoint.
Thanks to both Amy and William for their work and their presentations.
Chairperson, can I take a minute? I just wanted to mention one of the attendees raised her hand during the staff presentations, and I just want to make sure that it's not about requesting to remove an item from the consent calendar. So if it's okay with you, I'll allow her to speak just to make sure. Deanna Ellis, I am allowing you to talk. You need to unmute yourself. Will you please let us know if that was the reason you raised your hand? You will. Oh, there. I see you've unmuted yourself, but we can't hear you. Maybe you're having an issue with your microphone. I'll give it another minute or so.
Whoever said Zoom meetings are like seances, that's very true. Elizabeth, are you there?
Disembodied voice. Huh? All right, Ms. Ellis, if you are calling about wanting to change something on the agenda or attending, could you maybe pick up the phone and give me a call? My phone number is 916-445-7019, but unfortunately we can't hear you speaking. So I'm going to lower your hand and please call me if you were calling about an agenda item. Thank you. Again, 916-445-7019. Thank you.
Just in case there is wanting to remove or do something before we take action, while we wait, does anybody need a minute or two break? Okay, we will wait to see if we get a telephone call.
Okay. But I think you could go ahead with the vote. That's
fine. Okay, very good. So at this point in time, we have heard the consent calendar for today, and I would ask if there is any commissioner who would like to make a motion.
Make a motion to approve.
Okay, I have a motion from Commissioner Brandes, and I think I saw a hand go up with Commissioner Hansen.
I second the motion to approve the consent calendar as presented.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. And I would ask, if there's any comments or discussion before we vote. Seeing none, I would ask Tara to call roll.
Mr. Chair, you have Commissioner Villano with raising his hand.
Oh, I'm sorry. Renee, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a couple of things. My job as a commissioner never ceases to amaze me. As an archaeologist, we've come across archaeological sites that I've worked on or districts that I know about or structures that I've slept in because they're hotels or dined in or visited or know that they're an anchor in the historical landscape of a particular place. And when the Griffith residents when I first opened that electronic binder and the Griffith residence popped out, I was floored, because my wife, Leslie Heal, her family, until June, we just sold the house, owned a residence about six houses south of the Griffith residence. And they lived there for 70 years, Margaret and Leslie Heal. And so knew all of the people, Three Arch Bay. And Three Arch Bay is a gated community, so very few people, unless you have access to it, get to visit this incredible place. And seeing the Griffith residence is very on there is very important, because most of the homes on North and South Lucinda, which are right on the bluffs, they've all changed. They no longer are these cottage houses. They are no longer the original structures that were there. Most of them, and I've witnessed this because I've been lucky to go there over the past 25 years, and I've witnessed the change. And I can't tell you how many times I've walked past the Griffith residence on the way to the beach. And every single time I've looked down and commented how incredible this place is and how intact it is and how it really sits in the landscape in such a beautiful manner. So that the owner of the Griffith residence recognized the historical importance of this is a major feat, I believe, and especially since there are very few of these original structures left, especially on the bluff. We just sold our property in June, and it was very emotional because my wife and her sister began going there as kids and swimming in the incredible waters there of Orange County with the beautiful views of Catalina Island. And so it was a very tough summer, and I spent time clearing out the house. And in that process, we were finding things that were from the 40s and from the 50s and from previous, family members. And if anybody's ever done that, many people have, it just begins to show the type of connections that history has. It's something that existed in the past, but it's a current that runs through us today. And I just felt like I had to share that, because I was, not a lot of people have seen the Griffith residence, and I feel fortunate to have seen it and to have walked by that garage, especially so many different times. And it was important for my daughter. She started going there as 3 months old or 8 months old, however old. And so it was very emotional for her. She's now 14. So I just wanted to share that. And because I think it's important to once in a while pause and reflect that our past is within us today. And this job, I'm so glad to have this, because it has touched me so many different ways. And I just feel fortunate to be a part of this. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks, Renee. And before we continue, Alan, I realize that I oopsed it that we should have the roll call vote, and then we will continue with comments. So we do have a motion on the table by Commissioner Brandis and a second by Commissioner Hansen to approve the consent agenda as presented. And before we have any more comments, I would ask Tara to please poll the commission.
Thank you. Commissioner Brandis.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Hess.
Aye.
Commissioner Swiro.
Aye.
Commissioner Villanueva.
Aye.
Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 6-0-0.
Thank you, Tara. And I would now recognize Commissioner Hess.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to follow up on Commissioner Villanueva's statement, because it isn't just this one really remarkable little compound of surviving buildings. But I wanted to point out that part of California's heritage is vacation communities, places where Californians, people from all over the world, really have come to enjoy California's coastline, mountains, etc. And that over the years has created a number of little vacation oriented cities. And I think of Carmel and La Jolla. Laguna certainly is part of that. Up in Tahoe, Mendocino, Palm Springs. These small towns have fostered a lot of what is unique about California culture and lifestyle and art and certainly architecture. Many of these communities have been very progressive in their thought in terms of lifestyle, in terms of, you know, health-oriented ways of living, bohemian ways of living, and they are really incubators for new ideas. So in voting for this one particular nomination, the Griffith House, it really is part of a larger trend in California that is an important part of the state. And I would note, as Renee mentioned, it is threatened. Laguna Beach right now, a lot of these original cottages are being replaced, and that history is being lost. So thank you. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Commissioner Hess. Any other comments from commissioners? I'm just going to make a comment. I just love the diversity of what comes before us. At our last meeting, we had, for lack of a better term, a spaceship that was that landed in the San Jacinto Mountains. And now we have a house with a lighthouse. And I just think that's awesome. I also want to recognize the North Sacramento School. For those in the Sacramento area will recall that for 40 years, North Sacramento was a distinctive community of its own, incorporated from 1924 to 1964, when the city of Sacramento gobbled it up. So it's nice to see North Sacramento's independence as a separate community recognized. And again, one more ask if there's any other commissioners that would like to speak on the consent calendar before we move to public comments. Commissioner Hanson.
I just wanted to congratulate the preparers of the nominations. We consistently see some really high quality research and writing, and they've done a great job on all of these. So thank you.
Thank you for that. We will now first hear members of the public who wish to speak to one or more of the properties just approved on the consent calendar. The order of comments will proceed as follows. The commission will first hear from the nominator or their designee. They will have 10 minutes. The commission will then hear from the property owners or their designee.
Chairperson Adams, I'm sorry, for this consent calendar, it's everybody has 3 minutes. That's for discussion items.
Okay. Thank you for that, sure. John. So I don't know if we're going to go in any particular order, if we're going to hear from the nominators or the property owners mm-hmm. first, but if there's any of those folks that wish to speak or you have in the queue, let us know, John. Thank you.
And actually, Ms. Ellis did call me during your discussion. So I'm going to go ahead and allow her to speak first. So Ms. Ellis, I think you're at the phone number, and that's the reason that we had the issue with not being able to unmute. So as I mentioned to you on the phone, if you press *6, oh, looks like you've got it. So I would like to preface this by saying Ms. Ellis is representing Cressley Homes, which is the owner of Jefferson School. They submitted a letter to us that's dated January 18th, and I just looked at it in the SHRC email inbox. For some reason, it wasn't received by us. So I will make sure that the letter gets into the file, but I wanted to allow you to speak, Ms. Ellis. So go ahead, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you so much, Chair and Commissioners. Thank you so much, Dina Ellis, on behalf of Cressley Homes. I did feel it was important to provide public testimony because our letter didn't seem to be appearing in the presentation discussion. We are supportive of the nomination, but there are a number of clarifications. Page and Turnbull is our historic consultant for the building and for that area. And they, Janon actually mentioned, I don't know why the letter was not put into the record, but she did, Melissa Gordeau with Page and Turnbull does indicate that although we're supportive, there are a few alterations that have occurred to Jefferson School over the years. There's an alteration on the east side. It's a block side. That's not during the period of significance, and it also does not support the Tudor Revival style. And then the rear of the building had an addition as well. There's a two-story addition at the rear of the project on the north side of the building. And those two areas are additions that do not appear to be historic to us. And so, Janan, I don't know if you can provide the letter and maybe put it up on the screen, perhaps so that the commissioners can see it. But we are supportive.
We can, most definitely, I can email it to all of the commissioners so that they will all have a copy of it. We'll make sure it's part of the file. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, Amy, but I believe that we do have the ability to update nominations before they are submitted to the keeper by our office. So if any of the information that you just relayed wasn't in the nomination now, it can be updated. Those are kind of considered non-substantive changes that wouldn't change the commission's decision, but we can, Amy can follow up and ensure that the nomination, when it's submitted to the keeper, does reflect the current status of the property.
That is correct.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
I can incorporate any appropriate changes as part of the final proof and edit. And as of yesterday, we had not received the letter. So thank you very much, Ms. Ellis, for resending it this morning.
Absolutely. No problem. Feel free to reach out to me should you need, I can research the address and the delivery. But just let me know if the email delivery is sufficient.
Email delivery is fine. Thank you.
I'll make sure it gets to Amy.
Oh, thank you so much.
Sure. I'll make sure it gets to Amy, and we'll also make sure it gets emailed out to all the commissioners just so that they're aware of the letter.
Outstanding. And that's the only testimony I had. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd also like to say that once we receive that and take a look at it, I think we'll ask Tara Lynch, our legal counsel, to look at it to confirm that it is not a substantive change that needs to come back to the commission. So we'll make sure to do that extra step and so that we're sure that those things, and if we need to bring it back, we do, but it doesn't sound like it, but we'll check with Tara as well.
Outstanding. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. For the rest of the folks who have registered to speak on the consent calendar, I'm going to go by in order of the items as they appeared on the consent calendar. So I have four people registered for Redwood City Women's Club, but I see some of you have noted you didn't necessarily plan to speak. Why don't I ask you to, hold on just a second. I have Elaine, since you're registered to speak on Redwood City Women's Club, I will allow you to talk. Ms. Parkin, just need to unmute yourself and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, I just want to take 1 minute just to thank the commission. Firstly, for approving our nomination. It's kind of an emotional moment. We've been working on this for a couple of years and it's been in the works for even more years. So it's really nice to get this far. And I really want to thank you for the work you do. I'm a former history major myself and an immigrant to California, but I just love California history. And as many people have commented, it's sad to see it disappearing so quickly before our eyes. So the work you do is just so invaluable for our current generation and for future generations. So thank you. I also wanted to really thank Amy Crane from the Office of Historic Preservation, who was so helpful to us in shepherding our nomination through the process. So thank you so much, Amy. And I wanted also to extend a thank you to our architectural historian, Mr. Bill Costura, who's just brilliant. We really, really appreciate everything Bill did for us. And I also want to shout out to the history committee of our club, who also put in many hours of work to make this moment come to pass. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Park. We're so happy that your organization was able to have your building approved by the commission. I do have three other people listed for Redwood City Women's Club, so I'm just going to call out your names: Hillary Paulson, Jane Taylor, and William Costura. If any of you would like to speak on this, please just raise your hand and I'll allow you to speak. All right, Mr. Costura, I am allowing you to talk. You need to unmute yourself and you have 3 minutes.
I'll try to take just one. yes, double my thanks to Amy Crane for helping with a series of edits. This was the very first National Register nomination I've done. I've done many other kinds of reports, but not National Register until now. There was a learning curve for me. Thank you, Amy, and thanks also to Jay Correa, because he received my first phone calls on this and warned me that there would be revisions. and it was nice to be forewarned, and he just gave a lot of helpful advice as well. And then to the officers of the Redwood City Women's Club, the History Committee, a good part of the report was handed to me on a platter. So I didn't have to do all of that research from scratch. That was very helpful. And it's just a great building in a great neighborhood. A lot of craftsman houses that mirror the craftsman style of this club building. I'd like to see them all preserved. That's all I had to say. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I'm going to move on to, let's see, Nathaniel Miller. Are you in here, Mr. Miller? Yes. Mr. Miller, you had registered to speak on one of the two schools, so I'm going to allow you to talk. You just need to unmute yourself. I will ask you to unmute. And you should be able to unmute yourself if you'd like to speak. I'll give it one more minute, Mr. Miller. Okay, well, if you would like to speak before we finish up with the public comments on the consent calendar, please just raise your hand. I will be moving on to, let's see, David Braff, who registered to speak on the Edward and America Griffith residence. I'm going to allow you to talk. You need to unmute yourself, and you have 3 minutes.
Yes, hi. I am the current owner of the Griffith property, and together with the great assistance of the chattel firm, I'm the sponsor of the nomination. I was really gratified to hear the comments of the commissioners about the property. We bought it about 2 years ago. We feel very, very lucky to own it. And we're just thrilled to be a part of the preservation of that property. Over the years, a lot of developers thought about buying the property and tearing the houses down. And luckily, you know, it was on Laguna's historic inventory and slowed people down in thinking about buying the property for those purposes. And so we were lucky enough to get it, and we are taking every step to preserve it. The comments made, Renee, your comments really resonated, because so many of the people in Three Arch Bay have stopped by our house and commented to us how grateful they are to see that we're taking steps to preserve it. So with that, I just wanted to thank the commissioners and the staff for the hard work and dedication, and in particular for taking the time to evaluate our nomination.
Thank you. Moving on, let's see, we have, Robert Chattel, registered to also speak on the Edward and America Griffith residence. Robert, I will... It looks like you have dropped out of there. Okay. Let's see. And that is all for the comments on the consent calendar. Back to you, Chairperson Adams.
Thank you, Janon. At this point, do we ask if there's anybody else who's not registered who wishes to speak?
Thank you. Yes, you're right. Please raise your hand if you are interested in speaking on the consent calendar. And if you're on the phone, you do that by pressing *9. All right, no one has raised their hand.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, John. Would anybody, before we go into the discussion items, is there any commissioner who would like to break, or is now an appropriate time to break if anybody wants to? Seeing none, we will push on. So we are now at item 8 on our agenda, and this is National Register of Historic Places, California Register of Historical Resources discussion and action items. The commission will now hear those nominations to the National Register that are on for discussion and action. Information concerning the nominations have been forwarded to each commissioner prior to the meeting and is on file at OHP. The commission will first hear OHP presentation, and staff report regarding each nomination. The commission will then hear testimony from those who wish to speak on any item. And the first item on our discussion agenda is Stuffed Shirt in Orange County. And before we proceed, is there any commissioner that wishes to recuse themselves from hearing any of the discussion items? Supervisor Hess.
Yes, I will recuse myself from this item. And on advice of our counsel, Tara, I will turn off my camera and mute my microphone during this item.
Thank you, Commissioner Hess, for that. And I would also ask, is there any commissioner that wishes to disclose discussions with any parties regarding any, well, regarding Stuffed Shirt? Okay, not seeing any. I guess this is the time to ask OHP staff to present information on this agenda item. Stuffed Shirt from Orange County. And I just love the name.
Stuffed Shirt, Huntington Beach, Orange County, is a two-level reinforced concrete building with rectangular plan designed in the new formalist architectural style. Located in an area known as Mariner's Mile, the building is set back from the nearby West Coast Highway and has a monumental appearance from both the highway to the north and the harbor to the south. The building is surrounded on all sides by a concrete walkway and low balustrade, sitting on a podium slightly above street level, with its partially subterranean lower level even with the boardwalk just above the harbor. The building's roof is composed of thin shell concrete domes that project to form a scalloped edged overhang at each facade. The exterior of the main level features a series of double height arched bays separated by narrowly tapered concrete columns. The south portion of the lower level is enclosed with stacked bond painted concrete masonry units and flush metal doors. The interior is divided into two main spaces, the L-shaped retail floor, which is largely open, and back-of-house space, including offices, restrooms, dressing rooms, and storage. The property retains a high degree of historic integrity since its construction in 1960, the property's period of significance. Originally home to the Stuffed Shirt restaurant franchise and now home to a clothing boutique, the building is a locally significant example of new formalist architecture and thin shell concrete construction designed by the noted architectural firm of Ladd and Kelsey in collaboration with renowned structural engineer Richard Bradshaw. New formalism emerged in the United States in the mid-1950s as the most openly historicist of mid-century modern architectural style, lending a sense of gravitas and monumentality to institutional architecture, but expressed with modernist simplicity. The Stuffed Shirt restaurant is not only an excellent example of new formalism applied to a commercial property, it is also one of the earliest known examples in the region, embodying the distinctive characteristics of the style. Thornton Ladd and John Kelsey designed Stuffed Shirt as one of their first and most career-defining commissions as an early regional example of new formalism, utilizing unique thin-shell cast concrete domes and arches in order to minimize weight and thus ensure the slender simplicity of the building's supporting columns. This effort helped define Ladd and Kelsey's practice based on structural and material innovations as expressed in their subsequent work. The property is nominated by a third party, Preserve Orange County. The property owner has supplied a notarized letter of objection. 33 letters of support have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Stuffed Shirt eligible for the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion C at the local level of significance with a period of significance of 1960. This concludes the staff report.
Thank you, William. And I would ask Janan to check me if I get anything out of order, but I understand we will now hear comments on this item. The order of comments will proceed as follows. The commission will first hear from the nominator or his or her or their designee. They have 10 minutes. The commission will then hear from the property owner or his or her or their designee. They will also have 10 minutes. And then we will move on to others from there. But and so I don't complicate this, why don't we end there and identify folks that we're going to hear from first.
Thank you. For some reason, and I apologize, folks, there are a number of people who are showing up in the attendees that I never received an email that you had registered for. So I don't know if you might have registered for this item. So I'm going to ask amongst the attendees, can you please raise your hand if you wanted to speak on the stuffed shirt item, just to make sure I've covered everybody. I do have Krista Nichols and William Croner, but if there's anyone else who wanted to speak on stuffed shirt, please raise your hand. Okay, not hearing that, I will, Ms. Nichols, I have you listed as representing the applicant, so you will have 10 minutes. I'm allowing you to talk. Please unmute yourself, and I will let you know when you have 2 minutes left on the timer.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good morning, commissioners, commission staff, and Shippo Polanco. My name is Krista Nichols. I'm the executive director and co-founder of Preserve Orange County. And I'm appearing from my home office in San Juan Capistrano on the traditional land of the Huaneño and Ahakaman people. I speak to you on behalf of our members, volunteers, donors, and board members in support as nominating party of the stuffed shirt nomination. The work of architectural history that is embodied in the nomination, ably prepared by the LA Office of Architectural Resources Group and recommended by the SHPO staff, speaks for itself. And while I realize you judge a nomination on its own merits, I thought it may be of interest to you to understand the bigger current picture. The stuffed shirt represents Preserve Orange County's first direct sponsorship of a nomination to the National Register or California Register. We're a five-year-old organization with a mission to promote the conservation of the county's architectural and cultural heritage through research, education, and advocacy. There has been a pent-up enthusiasm in our county for an organization like ours, and the stuffed shirt has channeled some of that. The 30-plus letters of support for the nomination that were sent to the SHPO are an example of the enthusiasm for preservation, and of course, for this small masterpiece, the stuffed shirt. The impetus for our involvement with this property, and ultimately for the nomination, is a private redevelopment plan that, as originally proposed, omitted the stuffed shirt altogether. In the current proposal, the building remains, but a parking garage is planned immediately adjacent to it on what is now the surface parking lot between the building and Pacific Coast Highway. The surface parking lot has been identified as a character-defining feature of the property and as part of the historic boundary of the site. A parking garage would obstruct the building and eliminate the critical view corridor from the Coast Highway. And it would also probably mar the view of the building from the harbor. We can't rely on local regulations to protect the stuffed shirt. The city of Newport Beach has an outdated and limited local register and does not have a preservation ordinance or program. With minimal environmental scrutiny, the city has permitted the demolition and alteration of countless 20th century gems, including in 2019, one of the oldest beach homes belonging to the Irvines, who own much of the coastal land that is now Newport Beach. Before I close, I want to recognize the large group of lovers of modern architecture that enabled us to fund the nomination. The organizers of Modernism Week in Palm Springs gave us a regional platform in February 2020 to raise awareness of the building and of modernism generally in Orange County. Joan and Gary Gann gave freely of their time and home for our fundraiser, and all of the guests who bought tickets and attended our events in Palm Springs. The artist known as Shag, who is a resident of Orange County, contributed a custom print of the stuffed shirt for each guest at our fundraiser. He grew up sailing in Newport Harbor and still paddle boards in front of the stuffed shirt. Jenny, Brent, and Liz Kelsey, the adult children of architect John Kelsey, who with his partner Thornton Ladd designed the stuffed shirt, made our fundraiser extra special for their participation. Residents of the Newport Heights and Mariner's Mile neighborhoods that surround the stuffed shirt, especially Peggy Palmer, as well as residents of Greater Newport Beach, especially Sarah McElroy, have contributed their financial, moral, and political support to this effort. This is a community that is on fire right now, actively engaged in the protection of its historic landscape and built environment. And we are lucky to learn from them and will continue to do what we can to help them. Honorable commissioners, on behalf of all of us, please approve our nomination of the stuffed shirt to the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols. All right. Next up, we have William Croner. Mr. Croner, I'm going to allow you to talk. You need to unmute yourself, and because I have you listed as a member of the public, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. A little, let's see. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, I will do my best. It's an old computer system. I am a member of the Board of Preserve OC, just to disclose my interest, and so I fully support everything that Ms. Nichols has just said. I want to emphasize the connection of this property to your criterion C. It is an iconic 1960s property that has had a prominent place on the, and I would note in the staff presentation and in some of the records, it says that this property is located in Huntington Beach. In fact, it is located in Newport Beach, and I would ask that the commission's records be modified or amended to the extent necessary to reflect that fact. It should be quite easy to confirm. But it is an iconic 60s building that sits clearly prominently on the waterfront. I have the good fortune to have a retirement home that is across the water and looks across the water to the property. But I have fond memories from, it says 1960s to me. I should go prom date there in the spring of 1962 to the Stuffed Shirt restaurant. And so it's a wonderful memory, and I just want to emphasize the connection it has to the important and distinctive architectural heritage of the 1960s. Thank you for allowing me to come in.
Thank you, Mr. Cronin. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on this agenda item, the Stuffed Shirt? Please raise your hand. All right, not seeing any raised hands. Back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janon. At this point in time, I would ask any commissioners if they have any comments, discussion, and or motions. Commissioner Sriro.
Yeah, I'd like to understand the nature and context of the objection from the landowner. Do we have any other information regarding the objection and why it was on discussion?
We received a notarized letter of objection, but it did not include any information regarding reasons for the objection. And I did want to say that, yes, it's Newport Beach rather than Huntington Beach. I'm sorry, I misspoke in my presentation.
Okay.
Thank you for that, William. I guess I would also ask at this point in time, since there is an objection from the property owner, Janon or Julie, can you advise what will happen if we approve? Does this get listed or eligible for listing?
Because there's an owner objection, the item before you is a determination of eligibility recommendation to the keeper. So. And then the keeper's role then is to confirm or not confirm that eligibility recommendation.
Thank you for that. Any other questions, comments, discussion from members of the commission? Any motions from any member of the commission?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Okay, we have a motion from Commissioner Brandes.
I'll second. After you.
We're going to have an arm wrestle for the second. Tara, I'll let you decide whether you like Adam or Renee better.
Oh, that's a tough call. But I do believe Commissioner Shrew seconded first.
Okay, very good. Okay, any other comments before we have a vote? Okay, I will ask Tara to poll the commission.
Thank you. Commissioner Brandes.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Shrew.
Aye.
Commissioner Volanowicz.
Aye.
Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 5-0-0.
Just a point of order now. Before we move on to the next item, do we have comments now on this, or do we wait until we finish the next item?
You can have comments now if you'd like. And I believe it's okay for Commissioner Hess to return to the meeting now.
Tara? Very good. Very good. So we hopefully will get Alan back. Hopefully he's at least listening to us, and we'll come back when he wishes. There he is. Okay. And I guess I would ask now if any commissioner has any comments on the item we just approved. Commissioner Hanson.
I just want to say that this is what I would call a no-brainer in the field of historic preservation. It's really just a beautiful and elegant example of the new formalism, and I'm really happy to see it nominated.
Thank you for that. Any other comments? Okay, we will move on to our next discussion item, and this is Pomeroy Green. And I guess we will ask for the staff report first.
Pomeroy Green is an Eichler Homes mid-century modern multifamily housing complex located on the northeast corner of Pomeroy Avenue and Benton Street near the western limits of the city of Santa Clara. The complex is in a primarily residential zoned part of the city consisting of tract homes and schools and a church. The district includes 16 multifamily buildings of varied configurations ranging from 2 to 8 two-story townhouses per building and a clubhouse set in an extensively landscaped grounds. Next, please. Buildings are oriented on a north-south or east-west axis and arranged in a manner to enclose motor courts, parking lots, or social spaces. Buildings are constructed of concrete masonry unit walls and post and beam construction, allowing the fronts and backs of each townhouse to feature large expanses of glass windows and sliding glass doors. Wood siding and panels of stucco are also used on the exterior walls. Townhouses are all the same size, and each successive townhouse in a building is a mirror image of its adjacent neighbor. Next, please. Only small changes have been made to its design and materials, including replacement of some doors and windows and addition of some fireplaces and additional parking. The district is in good condition and retains historic integrity. Pomeroy Green is nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of community planning and development for its pioneering use of cluster development. The district is also nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the areas of architecture and landscape architecture. Next, please. Pomeroy Green embodies the distinctive characteristics of modern building design, materials, and methods, and is an exceptional residential example by regionally prominent post-World War II merchant builder Joseph Eichler, architect Claude Oakland, and landscape architects Sasaki Walker and Associates. The period of significance is 1963, the year construction was completed. Next, please. The property is nominated by the owner of a resource within the district. The Historical and Landmarks Commission, in its role as representative of the City of Santa Clara, a certified local government, received a copy of the nomination. A response was received from the city on January 22, 2021, and was reviewed by Office of Historic Preservation staff. Next, please. In accordance with the National Historic Preservation Act, Title 54 of the United States Code, Chapter 3025, Section 302504, Participation of Certified Local Governments in National Register Nominations, if both the Local Historic Preservation Commission and the Chief Local Elected Official recommend that a property not be nominated, the State Historic Preservation Officer shall take no further action unless within 30 days of the receipt of such recommendation by the State Historic Preservation Officer, an appeal is filed with the state. Next, please. In the case of Pomeroy Green National Register nomination, although the City Council objected to the nomination, the Local Historic Preservation Commission did not object. Therefore, the requirements of Section 302504 have not been met, and the State Historical Resources Commission can hear the nomination. 7 letters of support have been received from owners of district resources. In response to the city's letter, the applicant commented on the conditions requested. An additional letter of support was received yesterday from the Pomeroy Green Cooperative Corporation Board of Directors. Next, please. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Pomeroy Green is eligible under National Register Criteria A and C at the local level of significance with a 1963 period of significance. This concludes the staff report.
Thank you for that, Amy. We will now hear comments on this item. And the order of comments will proceed as follows. First, we will hear from the nominator or his or her or their designee. And I would ask Janan to see if we have anybody in the queue to speak. And they have 10 minutes.
Yes, Kenneth Kratz, I believe you are the nomination preparer, the applicant. I'm going to allow you to talk. Oh, hold on just a minute, Mr. Kratz. I do have someone who just raised their hand, Mr. Weinstein. I'm going to allow you to talk just in case you wanted to ask a question. Otherwise, I do have you listed as a member of the public who would like to speak, but you would come later. So I'm going to allow you to talk. So please unmute yourself and just let us know, did you have a question?
No, not at all. Let Ken talk first.
Okay, great. I'll be calling on you after we go through the applicant and then the property owners. So hold on just a minute. All right. So Mr. Kratz, if you want to unmute yourself, I'll ask you to unmute yourself. And you have 10 minutes, and I will let you know when there's 2 minutes left on the timer. Nope. Looks like you muted yourself again. I'll ask to unmute.
There you go. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Members of the commission, my name is Ken Kratz, and I prepared the nomination to register Pomeroy Green on the National Register of Historic Places. I am also a resident and shareholder at Pomeroy Green. Please approve the application and submit it to the keeper of the register for inclusion on the National Register of Historic Places. This is a wonderful opportunity to recognize an important multifamily housing complex of mid-century modern design developed by a locally prominent developer, merchant builder Joseph Eichler, and his locally prominent architect Claude Oakland, and landscape architects and site planning consultants, Sasaki Walker and Associates. Pomeroy Green is worthy of historic designation. The complex has been featured in many contemporaneous and present-day periodicals and books on architecture and community planning and development. Those periodicals and books are fully referenced in the application and support the arguments made in the application. Registration will increase interest in architecture in the city, state, and nation by bringing this lesser-known Eichler project to the attention of not only architects, landscape architects, site planners, and architectural historians, but also students, neighborhood residents, Santa Clarans, and the general public. The information in the application can guide Pomeroy Green in their efforts to preserve the architectural qualities of the complex and can enhance efforts to preserve the neighborhood's character. My undergraduate training helped me in this nomination effort. I received an undergraduate degree in architecture, an AB in environmental design with a major in architecture from UC Berkeley. The degree required I successfully pass courses in architectural history by Professor Stephen Tobriner. My work experience has also helped me in this nomination effort. While employed at the City of Santa Clara, 26 years as a public works inspector and 4 as an engineering aide, I inspected repairs to 2 historic homes in the city, one being the Harris Lass House. During my career, I also inspected the construction of concrete reinforced buildings, steel buildings, and wood frame buildings, in addition to inspecting civil engineering works, including storm drains, sanitary sewers, underground utilities, pump stations, street pavements, sidewalks, and traffic signals. I worked on the application for over 2 years. I conducted the research and I am responsible for the narrative, building surveys, photographs, and drawings. I want to acknowledge others who contributed to the application. The early versions of the Google Maps of the complex were provided by Abhishek Raman. Diane Harrison proofread early versions of the narrative and helped with the building surveys. Shalini Venkatesh of Pomeroy West, another multifamily Eichler complex located across the street from Pomeroy Green, also proofread my early versions of the application and is now working with a few other homeowners at Pomeroy West to put together a similar application for their complex. I want to thank the staff of the Office of Historic Preservation for their help, particularly Amy Crane, state historian too, who patiently answered my questions and reviewed the application multiple times as I made revisions to meet the requirements. Rather than repeating the state historian's presentation, I want to highlight a few points made in the nomination regarding community planning and development described in Section 8, Criterion A, describing areas of significance, and the conveyance of feeling mentioned in Section 7, describing the characteristics of the complex. I want to give you a sense of what it's like to experience Pomeroy Green. As mentioned in the nomination, the architecture of Pomeroy Green conveys the feeling of the early 1960s, a time when people were exuberant about all things modern, including electronics, television, outer space, automobile culture, and leisure and recreational activities. The modern design of the complex, with buildings featuring crisp rectangular shaped forms that contrast with the organic shapes of the trees, is visually striking. The complex exudes a sense of modernism due to its irregularity of repeated forms and repeated building components, its lack of architectural ornamentation, and its straightforward use of materials. These architectural characteristics have made Pomeroy Green a tourist attraction, and the complex is internationally known. The complex was visited by 20 architects from Holland a few years ago. I made a presentation to them in our clubhouse, gave a tour of the grounds, and opened my unit for viewing. The feelings Pomeroy Green conveys have been noted by my relatives. When my elderly father, an industrial engineer by profession, came to visit years ago, he was astonished by the amount of light and airiness of the interior of my unit, and he enjoyed the view to the backyard through the expansive floor-to-ceiling glass windows. He sat comfortably inside, admiring the view while he drank a cup of coffee, and asked me questions about the design of the place while I prepared lunch in the nearby kitchen. The view made such an impression on him that he mentioned to me that he once thought about becoming an architect. The experience of being in the unit evidently brought back that memory because I'd never heard that story before. Upon entering my unit, my father-in-law stood for a minute in awe while he gazed through the large floor-to-ceiling glass windows into the front small yard. The view of the landscape framed by the glass is mesmerizing. It looks like an impressionist painting, only animated with dappled light created by the evergreen pear trees' leaves fluttering in the breeze. The feelings Pomeroy Green conveys are shared with the wider neighborhood. City residents can view the complex from the city street and look down Pomeroy Green's long driveways to see a spectacular sight, the evergreen pear trees blooming in spring, with the rectangular buildings providing a background. The trees form a canopy of bright flowers over the long driveways, enclosing and defining that space. And when the blossoms fall, they cover everything for days with a fine dusting of white colored petals. As mentioned in the nomination in Section 8, while landscape architecture is an area of significance, it is typically associated with Criterion C. At Pomeroy Green, the landscape architecture exemplifies community planning and development addressed under Criterion A. A residential development of low to moderate cost housing located on previously undeveloped land designed by collaborating professionals, planners, architects, and landscape architects to provide comprehensive amenities with the goal of fostering community among its residents. This collaboration results in residential development that includes positive outdoor space, undivided by property lines, easily accessible by residents. The community planning features that foster community are important to the residents here. My wife and I enjoy going to the community potlucks and other special events at the clubhouse and hope those activities will resume once the pandemic is over. Youths frequently use the small basketball court. Children play in the playground on occasion. The pool is popular too. Residents enjoy sunning themselves around the pool and on the benches spread throughout the complex. Others enjoy walking around the pathways around the central commons that is separate from vehicle traffic. Pomeroy Green is a wonderful place to live, and I think the areas of significance described in the nomination, the architecture, landscape architecture, and the community planning and development are largely responsible for how everything looks and works here. My wife, Diane, has told me she never wants to move because she likes the clothes washer and dryer location on the second floor, close to the bedrooms and closets. Simple design decisions like this that I have mentioned in the nomination are important and often overlooked in evaluating the success of a project. Thank you for considering the nomination to register Pomeroy Green on the National Register of Historic Places. Your approval will help Pomeroy Green become part of the city's, state's, and nation's architectural heritage. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have about the application. I am proud of my work. Completing the application has been an intellectual journey for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kratz. I'm going to move on. I have two individuals who are registered, who we believe are owners, and then I will ask for any other owners of properties in Pomeroy Green to raise your hand. But I'm going to go in the order in which you registered. So next up, we have Diane Harrison. Ms. Harrison, I'm allowing you to talk. Please unmute yourself, and you have 10 minutes.
I hadn't prepared to speak. I was just listening.
Okay.
But I encourage you to approve the nomination. That's primarily it. Thank you.
Thank you. And next I have Satish Mugi. Let me scroll down. Oh, I believe Satish Mugi has left the meeting. Okay. So let's see. Next up. Dave Weinstein, let's see, where are you? There we go. I am allowing you to talk.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not an owner. I write for the Eichler Network publication.
Oh, I apologize. I should have mentioned I'm moving on to the public now. We had worked our way through owners, so go ahead.
That's what I was saying. I write for the Eichler Network. And the last time I was at one of your meetings was when you approved the nomination for Fair Glen in San Jose. And I'm looking forward to this neighborhood also being added because it is such an important neighborhood. Let me just say in passing that I wrote a nomination myself for an Eichler. It was the S100 steel house, and that was approved some years back. I think that Ken has done such an amazing job at this. It's just beautiful. So I won't repeat what he has said about the value, which I agree with. I was surprised by the reaction of the city of Santa Clara. I think that rather than send in what I thought was a somewhat rude letter suggesting that because he was not an official certified historian, that work by one was needed, I thought that was wrong. Rather than send that letter, they should give him some kind of prize, really. They should call him up to the city council and like clap and hand him a certificate for all the amazing work that he did. I think perhaps the city might have been slightly miffed because, oh, I don't know, they weren't brought into the action quite as much. But, you know, the folks from Fair Glen in San Jose came, there were like a dozen of them coming. They had a whole big group working. Here was Ken working on his own. And so this is a marvelous neighborhood, and I would like to see it get onto the National Register. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for reminding me. I do want to just ask, is there anyone else amongst the attendees who is an owner of property in Pomeroy Green? Please raise your hand. Okay, good. Glad I didn't miss anyone. Okay, I will continue on with the members of the public who had asked to comment on this nomination. I have, let's see. Oh, I see one of them has dropped off, Mr. Govan. Shalini Venkatesh. I am allowing you to speak. You just need to unmute yourself and you have 3 minutes.
Okay. Hi, I'm Shalini Venkatesh, just a member of the public. I simply want to express my support for this nomination. I'm not a homeowner or shareholder in Pomeroy Green, but I live in the local neighborhood just across the street, actually. And I believe Pomeroy Green is very worthy of being officially recognized as a historic place. I wasn't sure if it was appropriate for me to say anything about the response of the city council. I'll limit myself to just say, I believe it's largely founded on misunderstanding and is deeply regrettable. And I'll leave it at that. I would love to see Pomeroy Green listed on the register as it can only increase pride and appreciation in those of us living in the city, as well as those further afield who really admire its very distinctive type of architecture and landscaping. Thank you for giving me the chance to say something.
Thank you very much, Ms. Venkatesh. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this agenda item? Not seeing any hands. Back to you, Chairperson Adams.
Thank you, Janan. With that, we will move on to commission discussion. Is there any comments from commissioners, including any requests for motions? Commissioner Hess.
I move that we accept this nomination.
Thank you. And Commissioner Schwiro?
I just had a quick question. It appears that the objection was more procedural than it was criteria or integrity driven. And I was just kind of hoping that we can just get a little bit more insight into how it ended up on discussion as opposed to consent, because it seems like the nomination was sound, all the criteria were met, and it was a well-written nomination. So I guess I just don't understand entirely what the issue was.
I can answer that question. So we received the letter from Santa Clara. The local elected official did not agree with nomination until their local criteria were met by the nominator. None of them appeared to have things to do with the significance or integrity of the property or their eligibility to meet the criteria. But the Preservation Commission did recommend, and so in that for nomination for listing. So in that local government, you might remember we went through this at the August meeting. The CLG, it's an and, so it's the local elected official and the Preservation Commission, but because there was a split, we just thought it would be prudent to hear the nomination on discussion and action and place that information in the public record. So it wasn't a matter of the nomination having any issues to meet the eligibility criteria. It was just more a matter of prudence to have the discussion and action in the public realm because of the split of the local government.
Thank you for that, Jim. Go ahead, Adam.
Thank you for clarifying. I wanted to get a better understanding for how we ended up where we are.
Thank you. And just as a reminder, that information is also in the staff report that's made available on the public record, should anybody wish to take a look at it and look at those sightings.
Thank you, Julie. So we do have a motion on the floor from Supervisor Hess to approve this nomination.
I can second since I'm not on mute at the moment.
Thank you, Commissioner Schwiro. That's a really tough title for me to get out of my mind. So we do have a motion and a second for approval, and I would ask Tara to poll the commission.
Commissioner Adams, I just want to make sure, is there any more discussion on the motion and the second before I take the roll call?
Thank you for that. Any other comments from commissioners? Okay,
thank you for that. Commissioner Brandis.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Hess.
Aye.
Commissioner Schroe.
Aye.
Commissioner Volanowith.
Aye.
Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 6-0-0.
Thank you very much. So that is approved, and I would ask if there's any commissioners who would like to make any comments on the approval we just made. Commissioner Hess.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I'm so glad that we have approved this. I'm so glad that it was nominated and all the hard work that went into it. This is part of our mission to correct and expand the historical record. There's kind of a perception out there that California in the 20th century was all single-family residences sprawled over the landscape. This is an example from the mid-20th century of intelligent, master-planned, higher-density housing. And it is not the only one in the state by any means. It shows how historical examples, if we keep them around so that we can see them and study them, can be a model for the future, because we obviously do need more high density housing in the state, but it needs to be of the level of quality that Pomeroy Green represents. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Alan. Any other commissioner comments? Janon, do we have anybody in the queue that wishes to speak on the action we took?
Please raise your hand if you would like to speak. All right, I'm not seeing any, but I did, our representative from Los Angeles County was having technical difficulties earlier. She is now amongst the participants, and if it's okay with you, I was thinking this might be a point where I could allow her to say a few words, or do you want to hold that for the public comments?
I think now is absolutely perfect.
Great, thank you. Ms. Bodek, Amy Bodek, I am allowing you to talk. Please unmute yourself.
Great, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Adams and members of the commission. I am the Director of Regional Planning for the County of Los Angeles, and we are your 69th certified local government. I just wanted to call in and thank you so much to the commission and to your staff for supporting our nomination. We represent nearly one-fifth of the land area of the County of Los Angeles and do regional planning in the unincorporated areas, and serve about 1.1 million people. So for us to be able to effectively receive certified local government status is incredibly important to our overall planning program. We are celebrating our 100th anniversary as a planning organization in 2 years, and it should not have taken 98 years for us to start focusing on our historic resources. So it's never too late. I encourage other organizations to join the bandwagon. And just again, wanted to thank you so much for your support in our efforts. If you have any questions, please feel free to let me know.
Any questions or comments for Ms. Bodek? Ms. Bodek, I just want to say congratulations. You may be the 69th local government, but you're also a very exclusive county family now, in that you're only the 7th county of the 58 in California. So that this gives 51 other counties something to strive for. So congrats.
Thank you. And I am part of the California County Planning Directors Association. So I will make sure to sing the praises of the CLG program and to hopefully shame the rest of them into applying. Thank you.
The term is gloat. You need to gloat to them what you've done.
All right. Thank you.
Janon, anyone else wanting to speak on the action we just took before we move on?
Please raise your hand if you would. Not seeing any hands. I think we can move on.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Go ahead, Julie.
If I might interrupt you for one moment, we have two commissioners who have a hard stop at noon. At which time we'll lose a quorum. So if you don't mind, I might suggest we rearrange the public comments until after that and take the first two items of the commission discussion and action, which are voting items for the commission, so we can make sure to get that housekeeping completed before they leave.
Sure. So shall we move to item 11 then? And we will go to item 11A, and this is the approval of the State Historical Resources Commission 2020 annual report. And Julie, I will recognize you to sort of cue this up.
Thank you. I'm not sure if Steph had prepared a report. Amy, did you have something before I speak?
No, please go ahead.
Thank you. So Amy and Steph have prepared the report. You've all received it. It really follows the format that we've received from, we've submitted and been approved by our legal counsel and our director's office. Mostly it's informational. It really addresses the work that you all did in the last year and highlights and celebrates the amazing mosaic of historic properties that California is so blessed with. In the typical format, we've just included the language so that when we go to do the formatting, you don't have to come back and approve that again. So it's in its normal, in its usual state, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions or thoughts about it, or if you have any comments.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions, comments from commissioners for Schiphol Polanco, Commissioner Schwero?
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate the report being sent to us. I had a chance to read it. This commission has done some great work, and that's documented well in this report. One of the comments I'd like to make is in the program goals section, the goals are broad-based and pulled out of the larger preservation plan. I'm recommending that perhaps this commission take a look at the goal language and find an opportunity to either add commission-specific goals that would allow us to maybe get to some of those places we had talked about over the last couple of years regarding commission attendance, find ways of incorporating more of the CRIS data management into some of our goals, since that does take up a lot of our time and we have certain purview over access to that data, and just really try and, with the times that we're having right now, try and maybe look back on some of the things we discussed at our workshop in San Bernardino on commission marketing and finding ways of getting some more positive exposure for the work that we do on this commission. I know that since we went virtual, it's been an uptick in the amount of participants coming in because nobody has to travel, and they're now here to see us in a way that we never really presented the commission before. And I think it's great. And I think it's the start of a new way of looking at how we can broadcast and create some positive exposure for the type of work that we do. And that would also lead into however we decide subcommittees might work in the future and whether we can create goals based around potential subcommittees and capture those in the annual report, including metrics on how we meet some of those goals. So just looking at ways of doing more with the report and capturing more of what I think a lot of the commissioners do to advance their work in the historic preservation space as it relates to their commission duties. So that's my soapbox spiel. Thank you for
Thank you for that, Adam. Any other comments on the annual report?
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to provide some information in response to the comments of Commissioner Schwero?
Please.
So thank you. I just wanted to remind that the goals that are in the current annual report are twofold. One is that they are from the five-year broader Office of Historic Preservation statewide plan. And then secondly, this commission has voted on its individual goals in the past. I believe the goals that we have now were confirmed by this commission. But what we will do is go back and look at the history of that and be prepared at the next meeting to provide some information for your discussion, as Commissioner Schwero has suggested. And we're always happy to help think about ways to do our work better, to broadcast, to celebrate, to illustrate, as the National Register uses those terms, the work in the historic places of our state, and the interests and goals that you all have in your roles as commissioners within the context of the duties that are provided. So we're happy to do that, and we can get something ready for the next meeting for your consideration and discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Julie. Just to add on to what Adam said, I'm hopeful that maybe committee work in the future can fine-tune some of those goals and get us to where we want to go. So Thanks. Any other questions, comments regarding the annual report? I would just like to make a comment. In looking at the bios, I was reflecting on the fact that Marshall served with us for 7 to 8 years on this commission. And then I also want to acknowledge the veteran on this group who's been hanging around since 2006. My kudos to Brian, and what a cool legacy. Congrats. So with that, this is an action item, I believe. So do we have a motion to approve the annual report as presented?
I move to approve the 2020 annual report as presented.
Second that.
Okay, we have a motion from Commissioner Hansen and a second from Commissioner Lenowith. Any other comments or discussion before we vote? Okay, Tara, you're on.
Thank you. Commissioner Brandis.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Hess.
Aye.
Commissioner Schrero.
Aye.
Commissioner Villanueva.
Aye.
Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 600.
Thank you. We will move on next to item 9B, and that is California Historical Resources Information System, Chris Fees. And I would ask who would like to key off this discussion.
Chipo Polanco asked me to present, verbally present a summary of the report that you all received in writing, which was added to the electronic binders last week. So hopefully you had a chance to look it over. In terms of the CRIS inventory and responding to record searches, as you might imagine, the last year has been difficult for everybody, but especially difficult, I think, for our information centers being located at universities, which were amongst the first facilities, organizations to close down, and that created issues with staff getting access to the information centers, getting access to paper records, and also the difficulty sometimes in establishing remote access to digital files when they were used to being able to go into the office to access those files. So over the past year, the information centers have been doing yeoman's work of figuring out ways to work around their host institutions or work within their host institutions' requirements and still be able to provide inventory record searches and primary number assignments to CRIS customers. Back in November, I believe it was, we sent a letter out to all of the IC hosts asking for answers to basically three questions. One was getting an understanding of what their record search response times were, trying to figure out if there was any timeline for being able to get back to fully sort of all the services that the CRIS Information Centers had been offering prior to the shutdown, and then also asked about any digitization that had occurred over the last year, realizing that they've really been focused on record searches for the most part, but that some digitization had occurred. And then we also asked them for their standard annual reports for the last federal fiscal year. So the information in the report that was provided to you is a summary of what we heard back in response to those letters and in the annual reports that we received from the information centers. As you might imagine, record search response times initially during the shutdown for many of the information centers were longer than normal as they worked to find ways to access paper records or get remote access to digital files. As you might imagine, a lot of the information centers also rely on student labor to help with some of their work. And because students weren't coming onto campus to go to school, that labor source was also missing for a lot of them. So they had to rely on the staff that they did have, the full-time staff. I am happy to report that almost all of our information centers are back to pretty standard response times. There are a few that are still a little bit backed up, but overall, we seem to be back to pretty standard normal response times for record searches. One of the things that also created some problems over the summer and fall was a lot of the information centers got hit with emergency record searches for Cal Fire and FEMA because of all the wildfires, and those obviously had to be prioritized, and that pushed back a lot of regular record searches as well. Primary number assignments, which is an important function of the information centers, also was made a lower priority than responding to record searches. We put information on our website indicating, letting federal agencies know that for consultations with us, things didn't have to come in with primary numbers, so they didn't have to hold up submitting consultations to us because they were waiting for those primary numbers. So we seem to find a good workaround for that one. And I believe most of the information centers are back to fairly standard response times for primary number assignments as well. One thing that has come out, it's not surprising to any of us, that came out of the information that we asked about was the fact that those information centers that have more digitized files were better able to more quickly respond to the shutdown and be able to continue to provide services because they had more electronic files to be able to access remotely, obviously. So it reinforced the need to continue working on digitization so that we can get the inventory into a fully electronic form, and things like the shutdown, the pandemic shutdown, won't affect the system as much as it has over this last year. One thing that has suffered as a result of the shutdown, not surprisingly, is the ability for people to come in and do in-person record searches. None of the information centers are able to open up for in-person record searches, which a lot of CRIS customers do actually rely on. It not only created a problem for those customers in that they were used to being able to come in and do their in-person record searches, but it also created more of a backlog of IC staff conducted record searches, because those people who were doing in-person record searches were now submitting record search requests. So they were adding to the line of people waiting for staff conducted record searches as well. Unfortunately, it looks like most of the ICs won't be able to open up for in-person record searches until at least the fall. Some of them are thinking possibly in the spring that might be a possibility. We're continuing to track on that, but obviously they have to follow their host institution's policies and rules. And so we're hoping that as vaccinations pick up, that we'll be seeing those host institutions opening up again, either in the spring or in the fall, and our ICs could get back to being able to offer in-person record searches as well. Obviously, digitization slowed down last year in terms of the rate of digitization that we had been seeing the last few years, and many of the information centers were doing very well on digitization, really kind of working on things. So we're not surprised by the slowdown in digitization, but at the same time, some of our information centers have been able to continue to digitize, mostly as a result of needing to provide records in response to record searches. So those records that hadn't been digitized yet, when someone did a record search and was requesting that information, staff were able to get those records digitized. So we updated the digitization table by county that we've been providing to you for a number of years, which has percentages of numbers of records digitized in each of the area, different categories of records. And as you can see, we've seen a little bit of movement there. At the same time, those numbers do tend to fluctuate, because what happens is records are still coming in. So sometimes you might see a percentage go down a little bit because, especially over this last year, that information center has really been focused on responding to record searches. At the same time, they have still been getting reports and resource site records from consultants. So that, in a sense, adding to their backlog of digitization. But we have, those numbers haven't changed too dramatically in terms of going down a couple of percentage points here and there. But otherwise, as you can see, we're continuing to make progress, albeit slower over the past year than we had been leading up to the shutdown. And then as part of their annual reports, the information centers always report to us financial information. And all of the information centers, for the most part, are doing well financially. A few of them saw some losses last year, but they all had balances that were sufficient to be able to cover any of those small losses that some of the information centers had. And quite a few of the information centers did see their balance going up as a result of operational costs not being so high. They didn't have students working in the centers. They didn't have any staff working in the centers as usual, but they were still continuing to get record search requests and having clients pay for those record searches. So it seems like most of our information centers have pretty healthy balances right now, be able to weather a continuing shutdown for some of their host institutions before we hopefully get back to normal soon. I did want to report, two things I wanted to mention that are, one of which is in the report. In relation to digitization, we did receive a letter from the Society for California Archaeology that was provided to you as one of the attachments to the report. that basically is offering, realizing the importance of digitization, of digitizing the CRIS inventory, and offering assistance in some way. So I just wanted to let you know, as is noted in the report, we plan to follow up with the President, Michelle Cross, to have a discussion with her. And I believe that they've developed a task force to be able to help with this, to talk with them about ways that they think the society could help with digitizing the CRIS inventory going forward. So we're looking forward to scheduling a meeting with them to be able to discuss details and specifics and see if we can look to SCA for some assistance with this very important effort. One thing I also wanted to follow up on that wasn't in the written report, but we wanted to mention it verbally to you. At your November meeting, if you remember, Brian Mutch, who was the coordinator with the Northwest Information Center, mentioned a CRIS data breach hack that had occurred. And at the time, we didn't have a lot of information about sort of the situation, so we didn't want to bring it up in the context of the meeting, but I wanted to address it here. The information centers have been following up with the private consulting firm that had the data hack. As far as we're aware, no CRIS data was part of the data breach that occurred at that consulting firm. So there is, at least to date, we have not heard that any CRIS inventory information was part of that data breach. They have data that's apparently being held for ransom, but no CRIS data as part of that that we're aware of, although we're continuing to communicate with that firm in order to kind of track on that issue and make sure that that's the case. We are also looking into the issue of that firm, where that firm acquired that data from, but that's not an issue that the commission needs to get into, but it is something that that we're looking into. And then finally, the report concludes with a series of three recommendations. Two of them are related to specific information centers. The Eastern Information Center, which is located at UC Riverside, let us know, and they are the information center with the lowest balance in terms of their finances, and they do have a lot of digitization that needs to occur, and they have quite a bit of development going on in the counties that they manage. So we're going to be, Office of Historic Preservation is going to be talking to them about ways that we might look at helping to fund digitization of the records at that particular information center, realizing that they do not have a sufficient balance to be able to cover their digitization needs currently. And then the South Central Coastal Information Center, which is at CSU Fullerton, indicated that one of their big issues is a lack of space because they have so many paper records that they can't really allow a lot of space for staff to be able to work in the office, especially with social distancing requirements. And that means that they can't do digitization as quickly as they would like, or when the center is able to open up for in-person record searches, have as much space as they would like for in-person record searches. So we're going to be working with them on getting some of their paper files that have been digitized up to Sacramento or somewhere in this area for long-term storage by the state. It's something that we realize we're going to have to do with all of the information centers going forward as those records get digitized and they don't need day-to-day access to the paper. We'd like to see that paper coming to a state facility for long-term storage. So we're hoping that working with CSU Fullerton and the information center there on this effort will provide a good model for the other information centers going forward so we can get all of that paper into a good long-term storage facility managed by the state here in the Sacramento area. And then the third recommendation is a recommendation for the commission. As you might imagine, with sort of the turmoil of the last year, we are asking that you approve the CRIS fees as they currently stand for an additional year because of the finances of the information centers and the fact that we simply really haven't had time to dig into and figure out if there's a better way to approach the format of the fees as well as the amount of the fees. We'd like to have you extend them for an additional year so that we can do some of that work, look at the finances of the information centers later on in 2021, and hopefully come back to you at the first meeting of 2022 with a recommendation in terms of any changes to the fees.
Mr. Chair, before you go on, I just wanted to add a couple of updates as well. So you might remember that we had previously identified a potential FEMA grant to fund the complete digitization at an estimate that we had put together of what we thought the total would be. And that took, that process went on for a while, and we eventually ended up learning that we were in the wrong grant category for the one that we had applied to. So we're continuing our conversations with Cal OES and FEMA, as well as continuing to submit the total budget for digitization through our budget change proposal process with the state, as well as looking to other potential partners in the climate change arena within state government to find resources to continue to get that digitization completed. As well, we put last year and the year before, I think you know that we put money at the end of the year of our fiscal year into digitization of the Office of Historic Preservation Records. And last year we were able to fund to $80,000 a contract to get the majority of the rest of our backlog inventory scanned. And then students and our IMU will be working on coding those things to the CRIS. And then finally, I'll just report on the single system from State Parks. In COVID, many of the staff who were dedicated to working on our project got mission tasks to other duties. But I'm assured by our public, our information director that our project is on first on the list and will be engaged very shortly. So we're looking forward to starting our work on putting that process together, the container. So I just wanted to update those items and then again reiterate the recommendation about the fees. I think, you know, at this moment and considering what's happening, while we might not like the fees and you know, you've all heard me on them as a commissioner and as the SHPO, but I think that it would be really irresponsible of us to make a substantial change at this moment in deference to people needing to continue to do record searches and keep things going as much for the record, the information centers, as well as the public. I think it would be difficult for us to have major changes to a system that people are aware of and know now, rather than sort of this big upheaval. And we want to do that thoughtfully in a way that keeps the information flow going to the folks who need it to consider cultural and historic resources in their projects and just out of interest. So I just wanted to give you that little bit of information as well.
Thank you for that, Julie. And thank you, Janon. Any questions, comments on the report that we've just heard from both Janon and Julie?
Janon or Julie, has there been any discussion on revisiting the ISC operations manual, given the recent breach and the way that the ISCs have had to shift operations as part of the coronavirus?
Well, I just want to just make one point of correction that the breach did not release any information from the ICs. As we understand it, that information, that entity that had the information had a threat of their information being held hostage, but no information was released. I think in that situation, we understand that we're looking into how the information transferred from the person that received it to the ones that had it. And I think that's really a matter of a subscription issue that we'll look into. So that, I don't know, would warrant an entire change to the system, but we'll definitely have more information to understand that. And secondly, about the manual, we have not thought about it in COVID. I think mostly because we're considering this as a temporary situation. And as long, you know, as we all are learning day to day what that means, I think the thought was just to really try to minimize any changes at this moment to not upset the process of people being able to get records and understand how to do that. But we certainly can put it, I mean, I will just say that it'll certainly be part of the conversation when we get to full digitization and what delivery of that information looks like. But we can take a look and report back to you at the next meeting if there's any changes to the manual that need to be made or that we recommend to all of you.
Yeah, thanks for that response. I understand that we've confirmed that CRIS data hasn't been released. I think when something like that happens and then you confirm that it actually didn't happen, it also just triggers a relook at protocol and steps that you take as part of kind of the natural process of looking at, you know, what we have that covers us as far as custodians of the data and
tracking the data ownership as it moves through the system and it's used for preservation purposes.
Absolutely. One other thing I'll mention that's sort of a tangent, but kind of not, is Wednesday of this week, the leaders of the Natural Resources Agency, Cal-EPA, the Department of Agriculture, and the Governor's Office of Planning and Research held a webinar about the governor's biodiversity and 30 by 30 initiatives, the two most prominent climate change initiatives that, that the governor has announced this year, end of last year. And in that webinar, I'll send you all the link if you want to watch it. It's really interesting. But there was a conversation about a new database that's going to be developed called CalNature. And as I understand it, it's the layers of the different state agencies and information that would be in a single source to do analysis and studies and predictive modeling and this kind of thing. And we're about to engage, I'm about to engage with the folks that are working on that. I think Esri is participating in some way with the state to understand what they're doing and compare that to what we're envisioning for the CRIS system. Ultimately, we'd like to be able to have them be compatible. I don't think housing them together makes any sense, but in a way that makes the layer of cultural resources in those decision-making available and known from the get-go. So things are developing all the time, and we're learning from our partners as they're learning what they're doing. And so the way to connect those things on a broader statewide level for total sense of place stewardship is also something we're looking at, and I'll report back to you all on that as well. I'll send you all the link if you want to watch it. I think that it was recorded. It was a really interesting webinar. And I think there's a lot of connectivity with the work we're doing that could play an important role in multiple outcomes in single efforts, which is what the state really is striving for in a lot of the work we're doing now and going forward.
Thank you, Julie. Any other questions or comments for what have been discussed so far? I know we have at least one action item on this subject, and that is with respect to fees. Do we need to take any action, Janan, with respect to Riverside or Fullerton?
No, those are internal or something that OHP can work on without commission action. I do have a few people who have registered to speak on this item, members of the public. I don't know if it would be appropriate to take those comments now versus after. Is that correct? Okay.
Why not now in case they have comments on what we're going to do with respect to fees? Right. I'm getting head shaking from the attorney too. So yeah.
Always go with what counsel tells you, right? Yeah. Let's see. First on my list, I have, Mr. Baker. Yes, Craig Baker, I am going to allow you to talk. Please unmute yourself and you'll have 3 minutes. Here, I'll prompt you to unmute yourself. There you go. Yes.
I have no comments.
Oh, all right. Thank you. All right. Next, I have Brian Much with the Northwest Information Center. Brian, I will allow you to talk. You can unmute yourself and you have 3 minutes.
All right, thank you. I'm not going to the coordinators on our Wednesday call had just asked if I'd be available to kind of be here for the commission if they had any questions and such. So, a bit to Commissioner Shiro, your question. There has been some conversation about relooking at the CRIS Access and Use Agreement, not necessarily our operations manual, but in terms of how the data moves around and how it's passed back and forth. The Access and Use Agreement is really part of that review process. I mean, a lot of the details in how that data is cared for, the custodian concept that you talked about, is built into the CRIS Access and Use Agreement, which was approved by the commission. So my guess is we'll be working with our new CRIS coordinator and OHP at some point in time to perhaps propose some changes and modifications to the Access and Use Agreement, and it would find its way up to the commission. Just if there were any questions regarding IC operations, the IC coordinators asked me to hang out here for you all today to assist as necessary.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's see.
that was it for the people who pre-registered for this item. If there's anyone else who has registered who would like to make a comment on this item, please raise your hand. No raised hands. All right.
Okay, thanks, Janan. So we do have the one action item on the recommendation to retain our fees until our first meeting in 2022. And I would ask, what's the pleasure of the commission?
I'll make a motion to retain the fees until the first commission meeting in 2022.
Okay, we have a motion from Commissioner Brandis.
A second.
And a second from Commissioner Schwiro. Any further discussion or comments? Okay, I would ask Tara to poll the commission.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Brandis.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Hess.
Aye.
Commissioner Schwiro.
Aye.
Commissioner Villanueva.
Aye.
And Commissioner Adams.
Aye. I'm sorry, Tara.
That's okay. Thank you very much. The motion passes 6-0-0.
Thank you for that. And I guess before we move on, I would ask Julie and Janan, do you have any other comments regarding Chris?
No, I think just that we'll, I thank you for the vote. We really appreciate the confidence and just allowing us all to sort of sit where we are for a moment in deference to making sure that we don't make things worse during COVID. But we'll have more information as things develop and changes are happening within the state about how things are working. So even though the fees are till January of next year, I'll be sure to give any updates in my report and we can update you along the way about things like our conversations with SCA and others. So we'll keep you posted at each meeting of any updates that are going on.
Thank you. And Brian, do you have a comment?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Adams. I just want to make one comment that, and Julie, I'm glad you mentioned that just because we, voted on just the fees, it's critical that progress, continue on the digitization efforts. And you mentioned earlier that on the number of years that I've been on this commission, well, that entire time we've been working on this digitization effort. So I think it's a personal goal that I can't leave until it's done. So we need to hurry up and get it done.
Well, so you've either given us a threat or a goal. I'm not sure which.
or we can blame the delays on him singularly.
I know. That's what I was thinking when I was saying that. So,
yeah.
But you guys, Janan and Julie, thank you both for the efforts and for the teams and the centers as well. So appreciate
it. There's a fuzzy line between threat and goal.
Well, I will say that it is important, and I couldn't agree with you more, Brian. As you all have heard me, the soapbox is getting large and heavy, and I think that there's so many other things going on that the ability to in the state with regard to digitization and information in this new administration with real goals of this kind of effort across the board. So I feel like we're just continuing to tap into those and find those connection points. And someday it's going to work and we're going to get there and the stars will align and we'll get all the information done. But I think if COVID shows us nothing else, it shows us how very important it is for us to be prepared in this digital format to be able to adjust and keep things going. It's confidentiality is so important, but we also need this information not only to protect the resources, but to keep all the infrastructure going for our public. And so I think the new focus on or the heightened focus on climate change and those types of things will also help in our favor to get some greater progress in the coming years. So I'll keep it as a normal item on my update for you every month. If there are any updates or any questions or anything that you all have in the meanwhile, please always feel free to let us know. But I agree with you, Brian, that this will be one of the best achievements of my career in this field if we get it done.
When
we get it done.
When we get it done, yes.
Because we will.
And just to follow on from Julie, Julie introduced Mike McGirt, the new supervisor of our Archaeology and Environmental Review Unit, at the beginning of the meeting. He is also the new CRIS coordinator. We didn't think it was fair to shove him out of the nest and make him present the report for this meeting, but you will be hearing from him at future meetings in relation to the CRIS. And he did review all of the letters that we received from the information centers, as well as the annual reports. And he actually drafted the written report that was sent to you. So we're very happy to have Mike on board and looking forward to having him take on the CRIS.
Congratulations, Mike. Congratulations, Mike, I guess. is there anything else with CRIS before we move on?
Nope. Chairman, but thank you for taking those items out of order so we can both vote and have the participation of the full commission present today. I think you have two things left. We can talk about committees, or you can revert back to public comment or any commissioner's comment. So at your pleasure.
Do you have a preference?
I do not.
Okay. Why don't we, since we're on item 11, commission discussion and action items, why don't we move to item C, the State Historical Resources Commission committees. And would remind us all that we had a one-page fact sheet with some reminders from our May 7th gathering, and would look for direction on how we want to handle this item.
Yes, thank you. So we've had many conversations about committees, subcommittees. You'll remember last year, this commission abolished the standing committees that were in various stages of activity in deference to a conversation about what the pleasure and thoughts are of this group. So what the one pager that was sent out were things that we'd received from various commissioners about topics that fell into a couple of categories. They were committees, just presentations and workshops by external parties or some of you. I think that the success of that idea was demonstrated at the December meeting when the commission held its fourth meeting of the year, which was a workshop about the California and National Registers. It was a great workshop. Sorry I missed all of you. I did go back and watch it. I will also say that we've received a lot of incredibly complimentary responses from the public about that workshop, including people who were going through the nomination process currently, who said, if I had seen that before, it would have been so helpful for us to be more efficient in our work. So I think that the thought and the idea that you've all put together has been successful in the maiden voyage. And so really it's at your pleasure. You know, we can talk about committees versus workshops versus presentations. You can all think about themes that are your priorities and weave that into the goal conversation. It's really how you want to handle it. I'll just politely remind that we can be as ambitious as we have people to help implement that ambition. And so at the moment, our staff is, you know, really impacted by a change of work and connectivity, literally. And so we're happy to take on, consider, and figure out ways that you want to achieve the things that you do in that constraint. So really, it's a discussion for all of you to decide how you best want to use this time and this platform for the obligations that you are provided in your appointments.
I would open the floor to comments.
I think one of the... sorry, should I raise my hand first?
Go ahead, Adam.
Thank you. I think one of the challenges we faced when we first talked about roles and responsibilities of commissioners and OHP staff and how they would support subcommittees is the nature of noticing for the public and giving them an opportunity to participate. Where you would go to do that and how you would make sure that the location is ADA compliant and that everyone can get there if they could, and do we do that in a public space? Do we do that at our places of work? Do we do that at our homes? And then all of that kind of shifted a little bit last March when everybody wasn't allowed to leave their homes in certain instances. So, it almost kind of solved itself by the necessity is the mother of invention. And all of a sudden we created this virtual way of engaging the commission like we're doing right now, but I think that that method could carry forward to the subcommittees where you don't necessarily need to open up your living room or find a library that's willing to put people 6 feet apart. So from a functionality standpoint, I think subcommittees, and please, Julie and John, correct me if I'm wrong, subcommittees can work in the same type of virtual space as long as the virtual meeting is noticed with enough time and it meets all of those regulatory requirements.
Yes, that's correct. And our legal counsel is nodding in confirmation. Thank you, Tara. It is correct. And I will just say that as we go forward with whatever frame, with whatever topics you all choose, and whether that's committee or just workshops or a combination thereof of presentations, there's a bigger conversation also going on about public meetings in state government. And there's a huge desire, you know, akin to what you just said about having some hybrid approach to an in-person meeting, but still allowing not people just to watch it like we had before. That was a good leap to transparency, but to actually participate virtually. And so there'll be, as I'm, you know, sort of looking into my magic eight ball, some combination thereof of the way that we'll run our meetings, both commission, and then I would imagine it'll roll over into the committees that you have to have a virtual and in-person opportunity. And as those get developed and we know about it, we'll just continue to keep you informed and make some decisions about how you all want to work in those structures. But I agree with you. I was looking earlier, we had 45 people at the beginning of this meeting. We have 30 now, so that's a lot to hang with us in these conversations. I think at the meeting we had in August, there were more than 150, which is better, so amazing for us to be able to really engage with the public in the ways that we should.
Agreed. And I would say that anything on discussion isn't always the driver for the volume of people who call in. You know, I'd love to see a way for us to reach out to NGOs or avocational groups that have an interest in what we do and make sure that they understand that this is happening and it's actually quite easy now to participate. So right. I like that.
We have a listserv that people voluntarily subscribe to, and we push the information out that way. It gets to a lot of our partners. We do a lot of partner work as well as our Facebook and other social media in announcing these meetings in advance and in enough time for people to join us. I agree that, you know, part of the conversation about marketing the workshops in a way that people can participate and schedule in advance will just be dependent upon you all deciding what you'd like to talk about and us putting a framework together. So I think that's one thing to think about is, do you want to set some topics and have us put them on a scheduled basis in advance like we do the commission meetings, or do you want to do them on a one-on-one basis, or there might be a hybrid approach? So the extent to which we can invite partners or get the word out is really up to you all and how you want to decide what the topics are and what framework they might be engaged under. If that made any sense.
It did, yes.
Really, as far as process goes for today, just a couple comments. One with respect to what Adam said as far as how we legally meet. I think obviously COVID is going to come to an end, hopefully sooner rather than later. It will also be interesting to see how the state reacts to it, how much of this virtual reality will stay with us versus will we go back to the good old days that everything has to be in person. We see private enterprise, a lot of them wondering if they will ever get back to normal or if this is our new normal. So whatever policies we make, we have to make for both the short term and the long term, whatever the long term is going to be. And then I would ask, is it appropriate so that we don't violate Bagley-Keene before our next meeting to have folks submit just to you their items for potential committees as we rebuild this structure, since we do not have any right now?
Yes. So the format in the new normal, in the new world, will be two parts. I think there'll be, the state is working right now globally on what kind of framework for public meetings, and you know that also the allowance for virtual public meetings was done by executive orders of the governor. So a lot of that format will be provided to us, if you will, as they get worked out for consistency among state government agencies. But I think then we'll have some ability to flexibility depending on how you structure the things that you want to talk about. So I might suggest we have three categories, and one would be subcommittees, and the second would be workshops, and the third would be presentations. And I think that that would help us to better understand from all of you. And some of them might overlap, and that's okay. But I think it would help us understand sort of the total goals that you have about these things, and then be able to marry those with capacity to the statewide plan goals. If you want to relate it to setting new goals for yourselves, we can relate it to that as well. But I think in those categories will help us also understand what's possible by way of the background effort that needs to happen in order to bring them to fruition. So if you want me to say that again, it's committees, workshops, and presentations. Workshops. Yeah.
So I guess I would ask my colleagues to think about those three categories and maybe have some communications with you so that we don't talk among ourselves and violate Bagley-Keene, and vet through you what looks like the potential for some discussion at our next meeting, if that works.
That does work. And I was just thinking in the idea of inviting the public, maybe at the next meeting, the workshop should be what the committee's workshops and presentations might be, if you wanted to invite the public into that conversation once we synthesize your information to us. Perhaps we specifically notice an hour or two, however you want to do it, to invite the public to engage in those as well and get their input. Totally up to you. Just popped into my head as we were having the conversation about it, that might be an opportunity to get the public's input as well. And we can send out a synthesis and also the goals of the statewide plan to help engage people in those conversations. So just a recommendation.
So are we talking about doing this as part of our regular meetings, the quarterly meetings, or as a workshop?
Doing which? I'm sorry, Janet.
With the topics that you were saying, the subcommittees, the workshops and presentations, are we going to agendize those to discuss at regular quarterly meetings? Or you're suggesting we do that amongst ourselves? I'm not sure where this...
Oh, no. So, I think what Chair Adams was asking is that you send us all your wish list, your draft picks. We will then consolidate that into a document, send it back out to you all for discussion at the next meeting. So it can be an agenda item. It can be a separate workshop the day before the commission meeting. It really just depends on how much time you want to dedicate to it. I was sort of thinking also, if you wanted to invite the public, we could try to put some information on our website for the public to look at, to be informed about those items as well. And then going forward, whether they're a workshop part of the meeting or a separate convening altogether would really just depend on how we were arranging those specific things. So some of the committees might work the way they did before, whether they had meetings independently of the commission meeting and reported to the commission. So it's sort of two parts. How are we going to have the conversation? And then secondly, the format for implementing those items.
So for right now, you're looking for us individually to submit our ideas, concepts, whatever, for potential subcommittees, workshops, and presentations.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
To be discussed at the next commission meeting.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if, you know, with all the commute time we are all saving by Zooming instead of driving, I'm wondering if it's not a bad idea to have a workshop the day before so that we don't feel rushed and the conversation can be a little less formal to sort of preview what we will discuss at the meeting the next day, if that seems reasonable, at least keep that concept open.
I do, and I'll just say that if we do something independent of the commission day itself, we may just have the platform only Zoom and maybe not the broadcasting of CalSPAN, depending on what we can do with that contract. So I don't have an answer to that, but I just want to say that that might be a possibility. But we can absolutely figure that out. And it would just remove the ability to watch, perhaps, but people still could participate as well and register. So we can figure that out.
Very good. Commissioner has been very patient.
This is a good conversation. One thing I've appreciated about this commission is the attempt to be transparent and to reach out. So I was just thinking, what were some of the groups that I would like to have be involved or aware of what we're doing as well? And then how could we incorporate those in the workshops or meetings that we do have? And I was trying to think a little bit more broadly about them. The broader preservation community or people who are affected by historic preservation, there'd be certainly some of the preservation groups, the Los Angeles Conservancy, Preserve Orange County, Save Our Heritage, San Diego. What could they get from us or what could we get from them? But then also, you know, they're the businesses that use Chris and or the development community as well that are impacted or perhaps do not understand completely what we are about. And then I also thought going out to the fringes a little bit about some of the Facebook pages that I'm aware of and involved with. I after our meetings, I try to pick out a couple of interesting items and let them the people on my Facebook and social media know about. But are there other ways that the general public out there interested in history and so forth? How could we connect with them through these workshops as well? And what would they want? I have no idea, but I'm just throwing it out there. There's a lot of different facets to the general public out there that we could possibly engage.
Yeah. So maybe that's a fourth category for your submission to us, is what organizations you would like to see engage with. And you know, what platform do they currently exist on? I know, Ellen, you and I are members of some of the same ones that are only on Facebook. And I will say that we have a draft idea about whether we have a newsletter in the office or we have a blog instead. And so there might be some opportunities when we look at where that goes to replace the newsletter with a blog. And there might be, and we had envisioned when we were originally within the office having a conversation about making that transition, having guest writers on the blog rather than just it being us all the time. So that might be another opportunity to engage those folks in a different way and ask them to submit suggestions for blogs or write one, and we can go that way. So there's a lot of things we can do. But I think, you know, when you send us the information, maybe that fourth category of who else we might consider connecting with or we shouldn't miss would be helpful.
Can I ask a procedural question? If I want to brainstorm with another commissioner on putting this list together, a couple of commissioners who might have similar interests in trying to reduce the risk of redundancy in submitting that, we want to give each other a call or write an email. Are we allowed to do that in terms of non-noticed commission business to brainstorm about potential commission business?
So we do need to be careful of Bagley Keene, but it's not as restrictive as if there's a formal committee that's, you know, voted on by the commissioners. So as there's no formal committee, you can meet with less than a majority of the members. So right now there is 8 commissioners, am I correct?
7.
Thank you. So as long as you meet with 3 or less, you're okay.
Once you hit
four, you have a majority, and then that would be a violation of Bagley-Keene.
Understood. Thanks.
And just a reminder not to have a serial meeting that if three meet, those three can only meet, one of them can't meet with two others and two others and two others.
Correct.
Right. Thank you.
Walks like a duck. It's going to talk like a duck.
I know we are down to five in our quorum right now, and I don't want to lose the quorum, but I also don't want to stifle this discussion. But any other comments on this, or shall we move on? Okay, seeing no hands, I will go back to item number 9, the progress report on the National Register of Historic Places. I don't know what we normally do if we read the items or if I can just briefly say 13 properties were listed and they are listed on our meeting agenda. One property was determined eligible. It also is listed on our meeting agenda. And one property was moved and it is on our agenda as well. With that, I will move on to item 10, public comments. And whether we have any public that would like to comment on subjects other than items that are on today's agenda. And I will ask Janan, as our air traffic controller, if she has anyone in the queue.
The two individuals who had pre-registered for this item are not here, but so I'll just ask for a show of hands. If anyone, any of the attendees would like to speak on any of the items that haven't been addressed yet on the agenda, please raise your hand.
Excuse me, Janan, Chair Adams, I need to excuse myself as well. So,
Brian, are you leaving us?
I am leaving.
Okay. Are we okay to move on with non-action items?
Yeah, there's no more action items. I don't think so.
There's no more action items. It's all discussion.
Be safe, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
Bye.
So, no public comments, Janan.
I'm one more time. Any raised hands? We've got seven people still hanging in with us, so no raised hands. So we are good.
So I guess I would move on to item 12 then, commissioner comments. And I'm sorry we didn't get to this before Brian had to leave. So any comments from commissioners?
I'd like to volunteer to serve in the same capacity that that our esteemed colleagues served in regarding the Native American meeting. I'm sorry, I'm not saying it right, but Julie, you had mentioned a meeting on the 5th to go over tribal perspectives in the mission period.
That historic context statement is, we have an advisory panel, and we typically have always invited a member of the commission, should they choose, to sit on that advisory panel with us. I will say, Commissioner McKay was going to serve, and so we have that spot if anybody's interested. So I guess, Lee, if you want to, I don't know, if anyone's interested, let us know. And then if, I don't know, flip a coin if there's more than one, or how, I don't know how you all want to do it. So just let me know.
But Julie,
I'm interested.
I'm sorry, Adam, go ahead.
I'm interested, and I did sit in on one, although it wasn't the advisory panel. Where I met you out in the Palm Springs area, but I think that was more of an open discussion with tribes. So please consider me if you'd like to.
Okay. Yeah, that was a listening session. We were really happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks.
Julie, is that a chair appointment or a commission appointment?
It's not really an appointment of any kind. We've just offered a space. I know I sat on it for the Latinos in the 20th century. Janet, did you participate in the Asian Pacific Islander one?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and so we still have that second round as well. So there's two actually that we have open. So I don't know, Lee, do you want people to send it to you and you choose? However you want to do, it's fine. It's a very informal process. It's not a voting item. It's just if someone's interested, it'd be nice to have the commission participate with us.
Sure. A suggestion might be, do you mind, or did Janan, one of you, send out a member to the an email to the seven of us asking for a volunteer? And you might even sweeten it by saying Commissioner Schwiro has volunteered, maybe that'll keep competition away, Adam.
Yeah.
I'm happy to see competition.
Yeah,
we
can absolutely send that out for both of them. And then we'll also send a list of the things for the committee's discussion so that everybody can be reminded and also who to respond to on those. So absolutely, we'll follow up with those.
Thank you. Any other commissioner comments for today? I just have two short ones. One is I want to once again thank the staff for their written work and their verbal work today. I do wish, Julie, you could keep Jay from talking so much in these meetings. And finally, if there was any husky noises early in the meeting, I apologize, but I do want you to know they have great historic names. The little girl is Phoebe and the little boy is Mr. Hurst. So they do have good California name. So any other comments?
No.
Anything for the good of the order?
I just want to again thank all of you for your interest, dedication, the time that you spend not only with us, but in your communities. I say it, I'll say it again, because it's so worth repeating. You all do such excellent work and are so thoughtful, and we really appreciate that. And one other thing I wanted to mention just quickly is that we had talked about a way to honor both Marshall and Dr. Knox Mellon at the next meeting in a little bit more of a robust way. I've been in communication with Carlotta Mellon, and she's given me some thoughts and her permission, and I'm still engaging with the McKay family. But thank you all for your suggestions. We'll follow up, and we'll have some something at the next meeting, either pre-recorded or sometime. So thank you all for that.
Julie, thank you. And I think I speak for all seven of us that this is a great honor for us to get to do what we get to do. I certainly know I'm humbled by it. So thank you all. If I sense a consensus, I will adjourn this meeting. And you guys, goodbye, all stay everyone. Safe.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.